break from the Minuteman News Service.
This is Michael Stinson in Hawaii. Ed Gillespie, the head of the Republican Party, angered 9/11 families by describing many who objected to George W. Bush's use of Ground Zero scenes in his reselection ads as a...
Am I the only one who sometimes comes across a gut-wrenching, jaw-dropping story in the daily paper and then wonders, why did they bury this? Why isn't this the lead story on the front page? I had this reaction when I read a story with the deceptively bland headline of Modified Seeds Found Amid Unmodified Crops. Most people scanning the New York Times last month would either have missed this story entirely, since it was stuck down on the bottom of page 6 in section C, or simply would not have bothered to read beyond the boring headline. A better headline would have been Bioengineered Frankenfood Seeds Contaminating U.S. Food Supply. For that's what the story was about. It reported on new findings by the Union of Concerned Scientists, a respected group that recently ran systematic tests on the extent to which corporate-produced, genetically tampered seeds have gotten out of control and spread the...
News break from the Minuteman News Service.
This is Michael Stinson in Hawaii. Ed Gillespie, the head of the Republican Party, angered 9/11 families by describing many who objected to George W. Bush's use of Ground Zero scenes in his reselection ads as a...
Am I the only one who sometimes comes across a gut-wrenching, jaw-dropping story in the daily paper and then wonders, why did they bury this? Why isn't this the lead story on the front page? I had this reaction when I read a story with the deceptively bland headline of Modified Seeds Found Amid Unmodified Crops. Most people scanning the New York Times last month would either have missed this story entirely, since it was stuck down on the bottom of page 6 in section C, or simply would not have bothered to read beyond the boring headline. A better headline would have been Bioengineered Frankenfood Seeds Contaminating U.S. Food Supply. For that's what the story was about. It reported on new findings by the Union of Concerned Scientists, a respected group that recently ran systematic tests on the extent to which corporate-produced, genetically tampered seeds have gotten out of control and spread their altered DNA into previously uncontaminated seeds. The genetically modified organisms, engineered in the labs of such giants as Monsanto, range from potatoes that have pesticides built into them to vegetables that contain particular drugs. This test was of corn, canola, and soybean seeds that were not the bioengineered variety and supposedly would be pure, free of genetic alteration. The scientists found, however, that more than two-thirds of the 36 batches they tested contained traces of DNA from genetically engineered varieties, meaning that, despite assurances from the companies and our lame government regulators, the engineered demon is loose. As one of the scientists put it, the door to seed contamination is wide open. Even more alarming is the blasé attitude of the contaminators. Rather than trying to protect the purity of our food supply, industry flacks say that the world should simply agree to, quote, acceptable levels of contamination. This is Jim Hightower saying, if that's unacceptable, call the scientists to get the story the media is burying. 617. Am I the only one who sometimes comes across a gut-wrenching, jaw-dropping story in the daily paper and then wonders, why did they bury this? Why isn't this the lead story on the front page? I had this reaction when I read a story with the deceptively bland headline of Modified Seeds Found Amid Unmodified Crops. Most people scanning the New York Times last month would either have missed this story entirely, since it was stuck down on the bottom of page 6 in section C, or simply would not have bothered to read beyond the boring headline. A better headline would have been Bioengineered Frankenfood Seeds Contaminating U.S. Food Supply. For that's what the story was about. It reported on new findings by the Union of Concerned Scientists, a respected group that recently ran systematic tests on the extent to which corporate-produced, genetically tampered seeds have gotten out of control and spread their altered DNA into previously uncontaminated seeds. The genetically modified organisms, engineered in the labs of such giants as Monsanto, range from potatoes that have pesticides built into them to vegetables that contain particular drugs. This test was of corn, canola, and soybean seeds that were not the bioengineered variety and supposedly would be pure, free of genetic alteration. The scientists found, however, that more than two-thirds of the 36 batches they tested contained traces of DNA from genetically engineered varieties, meaning that despite assurances from the companies and our lame government regulators, the engineered demon is loose. As one of the scientists put it, the door to seed contamination is wide open. Even more alarming is the blasé attitude of the contaminators. Rather than trying to protect the purity of our food supply, industry flacks say that the world should simply agree to, quote, acceptable levels of contamination. This is Jim Hightower saying, if that's unacceptable, call the scientists to get the story the media is burying. 617-547-5552.
I wonder who that is. What can I do you for?
A yodeler. That's one thing you don't want in your house. One thing you do want in your house is a sturdy, firm floor with Plictanium plywood from Georgia Pacific. Floors made with Plictanium plywood are stiffer and more versatile than floors made with other subflooring materials. Plictanium plywood. Build it better.
When you hear how big businesses get all the best technology for the best price, does it make you crazy? To calm down, here's a thought from the voice of reason. Get a Xerox M15i. It's not just a digital copier printer that gives you 16 quality pages a minute. It also scans and faxes in color. All that and more for a $66 a month lease. Big business or small, what could be more reasonable?
Call 1-800-ASK-XEROX for business lease details, toner and photoreceptor.
Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends. Beautiful Thursday to you. Bright, sunny day here in the People's Republic of Vermont. And we have an extraordinary news day. Lots going on. Dr. Euron Brook is the president and executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute. Ayn Rand, of course, is the author of Atlas Shrugged and various other books, and was sort of the philosophical progenitor of objectivism, which some folks took and ran with and turned into, some would say, libertarianism, which has strongly influenced the conservative movement in America. I would say that a lot of the modern conservative movement that doesn't directly track back to Russell Kirk and back to Edmund Burke really comes out of Ayn Rand's work. And so it's interesting and useful for us to hear from these folks. And Euron Brook is the president executive director of Ayn Rand. Ayn Rand Institute's AYNRAND.org, by the way. As an entrepreneur, he founded three companies, including Lyceum International, a firm specializing in objectivist conferences and distance learning courses, and BH Equity Research, a venture capital consulting firm in San Jose, California. Dr. Brook has lectured extensively in the U.S. and abroad on issues related to finance, banking, regulation, corporate governance, and ethics. He's an assistant professor of finance at Santa Clara University in Santa Clara, California, where he's received numerous teaching awards. Dr. Brook, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Thanks for having me on, and I was a professor at Santa Clara, not anymore.
Did you leave voluntarily?
I took this job here at the Institute.
Sorry, bad attempt at humor there. glad to have you here. You issued a press release recently saying American businesses have the moral right to outsource to whomever they like. And, you know, on its face, I don't disagree with that, but I have a butt in there, but I suspect you don't. Why don't you talk about just lay out your vision of this?
Well, I believe American businesses have a moral responsibility to shareholders. CEOs are hired in order to maximize the long-term shareholder wealth, and if that involves hiring people in India or in China in order to do some of the work involved in making those profits, then that's what these CEOs should do. That is, again, I think it's their moral and fiduciary legal responsibility to take advantage of whatever's out there to increase wealth, you know, as long as it's legal. They shouldn't be breaking their law. They certainly shouldn't be defrauding their own shareholders. But there's nothing wrong with moving plants, closing down plants, and moving them overseas. It's a phenomenon that's been going on in the United States, you know, for decades and decades.
Since Ronald Reagan, in large part. I mean, you know, he really kicked open the doors and stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act and got business out of the government of or got government out of the business of business to the extent that he could. And now George W. is really speeding it up. Of course, Bill Clinton played his role with NAFTA and GATT.
So. I wish that were true. I take quite a different view of Reagan and Bush and Clinton. I think they were all anti-business, over-regulators, and Sarbanes-Oxley is the latest assault on businessmen inflicted by the Bush administration, which I think we're all suffering from. I think that bill is what is responsible for the recession that we've gone through over the last year and a half. But no, really what happened was the 1970s, the United States became very uncompetitive. American business became big and cumbersome and ineffectual. And what happened during the 1980s is you saw us more competitive, more efficient, more productive, and indeed millions and millions, tens of millions of jobs were created from 1982 till about 2000 when the economy turned. So Reagan and Clinton, to some extent, under their administrations, millions of jobs were created. America became a competitive force in the world again after really, I don't know if your listeners remember that during the 1970s, we stopped making VCRs, we stopped making TVs, we barely could make an automobile. We were losing in every category to the Japanese and the Germans. And I think we've turned that around dramatically over the last 20 years, thanks to a large extent to the restructuring that happened on Wall Street and to what today is called outsourcing, but to shifting of jobs that we're not very good at overseas and retaining and growing jobs that we're better at.
So the steady growth, and I think you'll agree with the statistics are pretty irrefutable, that the middle class in the United States was a phenomena that we really had never seen before, a strong middle class. I mean, there was a mercantilist class, there was the desperate worker class, and there was the very wealthy, basically from the founding of the country up and, you know, particularly during the Gilded Age. I mean, you know, led to this populist progressive explosion. But the middle class was sort of an artifact of the minimum wage laws and government being the employer of last resort and welfare to the middle class in the form of things like tax deductions on home mortgage loans. That created this middle class that was so strong and so vibrant from the late 30s, early 40s up until about 1980. And 1980 was about the time that the middle class began to collapse. And yes, all those jobs were created, but as many people pointed out, particularly Republicans during the Clinton administration, they were not well-paying jobs. There were lots and lots of low-paying service jobs were created. And, you know, everybody can point to a few high-end jobs, certainly, but the average income of the people in the bottom three quintiles has been, the purchasing power and income power has been steadily eroding. And we've seen this in the fact that now it takes basically two incomes in a family to do what in 1960 a single wage earner could do, that is raise a family, put kids through college, pay for medical expenses. And you think that's okay. That's the nature of the business, right? That's the nature of the business.
No, I mean, I disagree with all this. Everything you said in terms of presentation of fact, the middle class is definitely not a result of government programs. The middle class is a consequence of the Industrial Revolution. That's true here and it's true in Europe. The middle class started forming. There were no middle classes until the rise of capitalism in the 19th century. Middle class is a phenomena.
But wait a minute.
The
Industrial Revolution started in the 1840s, 1850s, 1860s.
Maybe even previous to that a little bit.
Yeah, you could say. But I mean, you know, it really picked up steam. You know, the cotton mill and the steam engine and all that. And there was no middle class until the 1930s, the late 1930s, early 1940s. So how can you say that the middle class was a consequence of the Industrial Revolution?
Because the Industrial Revolution, while it started there, it it increased steam, and I disagree about the fact that there was no middle class before that, but the middle class was created because of the jobs and the possibilities made possible by the Industrial Revolution and industrialization. Indeed, there is no middle class. You can have lots of government programs in non-capitalist countries, but there is no middle class in countries that are not capitalist. What you have is very powerful, very rich people and dirt poor people. You have nobody in the middle. And only in capitalist countries, in free countries, do you have middle classes. In addition, I do not believe the mythology that since 1980, the jobs that have been created are hamburger flipping jobs. I live in California, and the jobs by the millions that are being created here in California, all over the Southwest, really all over the country, are primarily high-paying service jobs that have to do with technology. A company like Cisco is primarily a service company. It's categorized as a service industry, yet pay is phenomenal.
But they're moving those jobs to they're moving those jobs to India.
Leaps and bounds with middle-class, high-paying technology jobs, while the Northeast, a shrunken population has left there and taken up these really wonderful jobs all over the Southwest.
But they're moving those jobs to India, and you think that that's an okay thing?
Well, they're moving those jobs to India, and those jobs are going to be replaced by, if the administration, if we deregulate, if we get out of the, if we stop controlling business, then I think we'll create even better jobs in the United States. Now,
such
I
as?
Agree with you on this point. I agree with you that the standard of living in the United States is not as high as it should be. There are too many people who are poor in this country. There are too many people who are struggling. There are too many two-income families. It's hard to make a living. The cost of living is too high. But the reason for that is too much government intervention. It's because of minimum wage. It's because of favorable laws towards unions. It is because of the difficulty that the government, particularly here in California, the difficulty that the government creates in hiring people. It is so difficult today to hire anybody. You have to go through so many loops and regulations and sign off on so many things. The companies don't hire as many people as they should.
Oh, come on. I've hired lots of people in my life.
Well,
you basically say you've got a job.
I just sat with my labor lawyer yesterday, and the difficulty of hiring people is unbelievable. The cost of hiring people in this country, it has gone through the roof over the last 30, 40 years.
And that's a bad thing.
As a consequence, jobs are moving to India, not because we can't compete, not because our workers are not as good as they are overseas. They are. But government has made it so expensive to hire these workers that it's much cheaper to move them overseas. If we want more jobs in the United States, get the government out of our lives. Get the government out of business, out of regulating labor practices in business.
1-866-889-8894 is our number if you'd like to speak with Dr. Yaron Brook, the president and chief executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute, which in the opinion of many is the brains behind the modern conservative economic revolution in America. So you're suggesting that the minimum wage is a problem. I'm saying that the minimum wage was actually reasonably close to a livable wage from the 1930s up until the 1970s, and then we basically stopped increasing it. I mean, it's been a long time since there's been a significant increase. Right now, at the minimum wage, you're below the poverty level. And you're saying that the minimum wage is the problem. I'm saying we don't have enough of a middle a minimum wage.
Look, at any minimum wage that you set, there are going to be people who are willing to work for lower than that, or whose productivity only justifies a lower wage than that, and there are employers who are willing to pay that amount. Therefore, at any minimum wage, however low you put it, there are people who are earning zero instead of earning $5 an hour, whatever the minimum wage, whatever they could earn under
I know that's the theory.
So
but
you create every time you enforce a minimum wage, you create unemployment. And
but the reality is that during the time that the minimum wage was being enforced in America and was strong, we had a huge middle class. And once the minimum wage started dropping off under Reagan, the purchasing power of the minimum wage, the middle class started to evaporate.
You yourself said that the minimum wage is a wage that allows people to sustain themselves. It's not a
but it
wage
doesn't
that
anymore.
To be in the middle class.
It hasn't
no
since 1970.
No ever in American history has allowed people to be in the middle class. The middle class thrived when America was productive. When America was, after World War II, when we were the only industrial power in the world, when we were producing for everybody, selling to everybody.
When 50% of our jobs were unionized.
We weren't exporting, you know, we were just an exporter.
Right, and the majority of our workers were unionized. And there was therefore we had a solid middle class. And
the standard of living today is much higher than it was in the 50s. The 50s is ridiculous.
Well, I'm pining for the 60s. You know, the 50s were building to the 60s. But it's,
we live today. You're pining for the 60s. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Dr. Brooks, we've got to take a break here. Hang on just a second. We'll be right back.
Oil took its toll on Alaska's Prince William Sound for years after a disastrous spill. I'm Richard Hoops for Earthwatch Radio. 15 years ago this month, the oil tanker Exxon Valdez ran aground off the shores of Alaska. 11 million gallons of oil leaked out of the ship and covered about 1,300 miles of shoreline. People spent almost 4 years cleaning up the oil, but a new study shows that a lot of it stuck around and caused problems long after cleanup efforts ended. Pete Peterson is a marine biologist at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, and he helped write a report on the oil spill that was published in the journal Science. Peterson says a lot of oil washed onto beaches that absorbed it like a sponge. The oil seeped into coarse sediments, and it stayed there. Peterson says it's only natural that the oil could persist for years under those conditions.
After all, think of where oil comes from. Oil comes from subsurface pockets. By putting it under the surface, we are approaching the sort of environment in which oil has remained for many years.
Peterson says the trapped petroleum caused problems for years after the accident. For example, he says it killed the eggs of pink salmon. He says when the eggs survived exposure to the oil and hatched, the fish were often scrawny and had a hard time surviving at sea.
The toxicity from petroleum is not simply, as we had contemplated 2 decades ago, a consequence of acute exposure. Rather, the oil has long-term consequences. What we may have dismissed in the past as insignificant actually translates into loss of animals, loss of abundance, production, and reproductive capacity.
Peterson says that it's hard to tell how long the oil will remain in Prince William Sound, but he says it could linger in some areas for up to 30 years. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Sea Grant Program and the Gaylord Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin.
If elected, I'll lie about weapons of mass destruction as a pretext to invade another country.
I'll call myself an environmentalist and gut clean air standards.
Our allies will go from respecting us to hating us, and I don't care.
I'll leave no child behind, unless they can't afford it.
I promise to keep you in a state of fear and anxiety, so you never question what we're doing.
And if you do, we'll call you unpatriotic.
The war they are in has been declared over by the same man who lied them into it. Their reward? Combat pay cut in half. $1.5 billion cut to their family housing. $20 billion cut to military health care. No health care for reservists.
Lancers, bring them on.
Thousands wounded, hundreds dead, and no end in sight. If we support our troops, why can't Bush? Or is this what they mean when they say an army of one?
Hey, how you doing? Got a quick question.
Yeah?
Who was Rudolf Nureyev?
Rudy Nureyev.
Rudy.
Okay, I know this one.
Good.
Wasn't he a... Nureyev. Wasn't he a defenseman for the Maple Leafs? Sure about that? Could have been a goalie.
Yeah. Hey, how you doing? Who was Louis Armstrong?
That's easy. He was the first guy on the moon.
Really?
You know, one small step for man.
Sure, one giant leap for Louis. Hey, young lady.
Uh-huh?
Does the name Caravaggio mean anything to you?
Wasn't he the guy that went out with that mob guy's sister until he got whacked?
You know, no.
Are your kids as well-rounded as they could be? Kids who participate in the arts do better in school and in life. To learn more about the value of arts education, visit AmericansForTheArts.org. Because all kids should get to appreciate Nureyev's dance, Armstrong's horn, and Caravaggio's brush. Art. Ask for more. A public service message brought to you by Americans for the Arts and the Ad Council.
The best of the rest of the news. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Check your weapons out.
Tom Hartman, exposing the con and conservative. Welcome back. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. And Rich in Grand Rapids is on the line. We're trying to get, we lost Dr. Yaron Brooks. And is he back, Louise? Not yet. Okay. Hang on here. She's working on it. But in the meantime, we have Rich in Grand Rapids. Hey, Rich, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Well, thank you very much, Tom. First off, kudos today to my man John Kerry for calling a liar, and a crook, a crook. Let's stay on messenger. I thought that's perfect. I did want to talk to Dr. Rand there. He was correct when he said that America thrived in the 1950s when America was producing things. And I think anybody who needs to know more about that should read Wealth and Democracy, which talks about what happens when two countries.
You mean Kevin Phillips'
being
book?
Manufacturing economies being market economies, which is what the mistake we're making right now. And,
yeah.
And nobody knows more about capitalism than Americans. We've been practicing it for over 200 years, and our own American experience discredits every argument that this guy is making. Unregulated capitalism, we know all about it. Go back to the 1870s when Rockefeller was getting rich and J.P. Morgan was getting rich and everybody else was working, I don't know what sort of hours for what kind of money, but you can bet that it was they were long hours and little pay. We know what unregulated capitalism is. You get the trust, it doesn't work.
Yeah, it's very straightforward. And there are no countries in the world that exist with it. I mean, it doesn't happen anywhere on Earth. And so, which is one of the arguments that always stops libertarians in their tracks. You say to them, well, show me a libertarian country. And they, well, there aren't any. Well, why? I mean, you know, you guys have been saying this for a long time. Well, you know, the big government people, they always want to stick their business in everything. You know, it's a nice philosophy, but
it's a canard.
Yeah, it is. It's a straw man argument in many ways. But the reality is that, you know, this is the philosophy and the I'm sorry, Rich. I just dropped you there. Yaron Brook just came back on the line. I pushed the button to bring him on, and I forgot to push the conference button. So, Dr. Brook, you're back.
I'm back.
You're back. Thank you. We've got about three minutes left in this break. I know you said you had to go at the bottom of the hour.
And I can go for as long as you want me.
Okay, great. And we were talking about that. You know, Alan Greenspan was initiated into the I don't know what you call it in Ayn Rand's apartment in New York City back in the 1950s. Was it early 1960s?
He was good friends with Ayn Rand, and they worked together on a book, Capitalism: The Unknown Ideal, where he wrote some essays, and they worked together through the 1970s.
Yeah.
That I think that he represents our ideas today. He wrote a book in the 19. He wrote an article in the 1960s, advocating for doing away with the Federal Reserve, and now he chairs it. So.
Yeah. Well. You know, and what do you think? What caused that?
I think that politics is very seductive. Power is very seductive, and power corrupts.
Yeah. And you don't see any role for government in constraining the power of corporations?
No, I don't. I really don't. I truly believe in a complete separation of government from economics. I think the power that today corporations have, where they can lobby, where they can influence politicians, is a consequence of the fact that politics has so much involvement in economics. Let's get the politicians out of the corporate world, out of our economic lives. And by doing that, we will eliminate the power corporations have over our political lives.
But, you know, you guys say, well, we got a break coming up, and I'll let you get into this after the break. But you guys say that, for example, government's enforcing taxes as men with guns, and that it's not a contract with, you know, two sides to the argument. That is, it's not a mutual contract. But, you know, I only have one electric company I can buy electricity from. I only have one phone company I can buy phone service from. How's that different?
Well, you have the option not to use it.
Yeah, okay, there you go. And I guess I have the option not to use government, too. I could move to Canada. But, you know, anyhow.
Pay higher taxes with a bigger gun. Yeah,
we'll continue this. We're talking to Dr. Yaron Brook, Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. This is Tom Hartman. Stay tuned. We'll be back. 1-866-889-8894 if you'd like to be on.
After the towers fell, our streets, homes, and offices were coated with dust-containing asbestos and other cancer-causing chemicals. But instead of heeding the health warnings of their own experts, the Bush White House told us it was safe to go back into Lower Manhattan when it wasn't. There is a better way to protect us, Mr. President. Take action now that keeps more harm from happening. Clean up the world trade dust that's still in our homes and workplaces. and be honest with us. Don't hold back health warnings that will keep us safe.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
The Israeli government's running for cover over its decision to make Arab construction workers on the Knesset expansion project wear sniper-friendly markings on their hard hats. They were required to paint a giant red X on their helmets. Supervisors said the markings made it easier for security snipers to track their movements on the job site. But public backlash began when photos of the practice in action were published earlier this week. Aware of the symbolism of the discrimination on a construction project involving the parliament itself, the Knesset repealed the policy yesterday.
To date, 170 U.S. representatives and 31 senators have committed to supporting the Employee Free Choice Act, a bill that would establish stronger penalties for employers violating employees' right to join a union and allow employees to freely choose whether to form unions by a card check. The AFL-CIO is planning to make the EFCA a key issue in the 2004 elections.
This may be the year the state of Florida strengthens labor protections for migrant farm workers. A proposal making it a third-class felony to provide substandard working conditions was announced in the legislature this week. And unlike bills proposed last year to improve job conditions for farm workers, this proposal has the backing of Republican lawmakers. The legislation also calls for the creation of a commission to track working conditions in the state's ag industry. It sounds quite impressive, but it pales once you realize the maximum penalty suggested for a farmer mistreating workers is a $2,500 fine.
The FTAA may be skidding off track once again, with the Vice Minister of Brasilia announcing the Buenos Aires meetings are deadlocked over agricultural issues. Buenos Aires was going to set the agenda for the Trade Negotiation Committee meeting taking place next week in Puebla.
The European Court of Justice will consider penalties against the United Kingdom for failing to abide by common continental labor law enacted more than 4 years ago. The case involves Great Britain's failure to offer adequate break time to workers in contravention of the EU's working time directive. British trade unions estimate more than 3 million white-collar workers alone are denied adequate breaks. Any adverse ruling might not amount to much, though. The UK has the option of opting out of EU labor law if it so chooses. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Is corporate greed primarily a male problem? According to Catalyst, a nonprofit group devoted to the promotion of women in business, it's hard to hide from the bottom line. It studied the stock performance of 353 Fortune 500 companies between 1996 and 2000 and found those with the highest proportion of women executives produced a 34% greater return to shareholders than the most male-dominated firms. Even so, only one in five executives at the most gender-diverse companies were female.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Bringing you uncommon sense, you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Special music for the Bush administration on their way out of town. Yeah, check your weapons at the door. We'll see. Will Mr. Kerry win or not? I don't know. It's going to be an interesting race. This is Tom Hartman here with you. It's 26 minutes before the hour. We're talking with the president and executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute, the philosophical ground, I would say, of modern conservative economics, Dr. Yaron Brook, Dr. Brook, you were saying, as I said, you know, okay, you think that there should be no checks on corporate power whatsoever, and if I've only got, you know, one phone company, one electric company, and everything should be privatized, and they say take it or leave it, that my option is to take it or leave it, and that's okay.
Well, I think that is okay, absolutely. I also think that in an economy in which the government does not have influence, you will have more than one alternative. The fact is that the less regulated an industry is, the more competition arises, the more choices we have, the more innovation we get, and the lower the prices. The price point becomes, the cheaper a product is, the more the government regulates an industry. Electricity is a wonderful example because it's one of the most regulated industries in the country. The more expensive, the more inefficient, the more technically flawed, and the less choices and the less innovations we benefit from.
But out in one of the western states, the local electric, I don't remember the state, but I had the guy on the show here last year. There was a family who had put up solar panels on their roof, and this was like in Arizona, as I recall. Mm-hmm. And they were generating actually more electricity than they were using, and they wanted to feed it back to the electric grid, and they had all the equipment. I mean, this guy bought a $22,000 box that would make sure that everything was compatible. They're in use literally in countries all over the world.
Sure.
And his electric company said no.
Well, the electric company is not.
We will not do that.
The electric company doesn't have to buy your excess electricity, but the electric company cannot stop you from producing the electricity necessary to run your own home. And for that matter, if the state stayed out of it, if you wanted to run a wire to your neighbor and sell him electricity, you should be completely permitted to do that. The things that really block this kind of innovation and this kind of entrepreneurship on the individual level is government regulation and, indeed, government protection.
So what's wrong
for these utilities? I mean, these utilities are not run as independent, competitive industries. They run as regulated, government-controlled businesses.
Yeah,
and
to a large extent.
The innovation there.
And I'm to some extent, I'm not disagreeing with you on that. No. But I really think that local community electricity is a great alternative. And one step toward that would be, I mean, what's wrong with government stepping in, as it did in the case of this particular local county, and saying to this electric company, "I'm sorry, you've got to take this guy's electricity because we want to encourage other people to do it because that's ultimately for the public good." What's wrong with the government acting on behalf of the public good?
Well, because I don't think there is such a thing as the public good, and the public good ultimately is determined by whoever has the most guns or the most votes, and that's not always what is right. I mean, the whole basis.
No, in a constitutional, in a constitutional republic, the public good is defined. We protect minorities in the United States. That's
but we don't. We don't. We don't protect businessmen, for example, who, you know, since the majority of people are not businessmen, we go after them left and right whenever we want to. We regulate them to death. We control what they
now,
can do.
Now,
what
there's
they
a difference
do.
Between businessmen and businesses.
Speech. There's no free speech in the commercial arena because we have violated the Constitution because the majority has decided.
Dr. Brook, as an individual, you have the absolute right to say anything you want. A corporation is not a human being. It's not protected under the Bill of Rights.
Of course it's protected under the Bill of Rights. It was meant to be protected under the Bill of Rights.
No, it wasn't. The founders fought against that. I mean, that's what the Revolutionary War was all about. The Boston Tea Party was a revolt not against the government of King George III, but against the East India Company's monopoly of the tea business. I mean, the Tea Act of 1773 was a reduction on the tea tax on tea.
That is an interesting interpretation of history.
Well, I suggest you go back and actually read the history.
The revolution was about government control of business and taxation. It was not about fighting against corporations. That is a very 60s interpretation of American history, which is false.
Yeah, well, the
founding fathers were revolting against the control of the British Parliament. They were fighting against the king. There's nothing in the Declaration of Independence that says that we're being oppressed by British corporations. It's all about we're being oppressed by the British government.
And the,
like
the British government's
oppressed by the American government.
Yeah, okay. 1-866-889-8894. Jerry in North Carolina is on the line. Hey, Jerry, welcome to the program.
I beg to differ with Dr. Brooks. If I buy a piece of land, I cannot start building a house until I have power put to that land. Now, that's something the government makes me do. It's not an advantage to government for me to have power on that land. It's only an advantage to the power company. And if the power company is a private corporation, then government is protecting that corporation the same way they protect corporations with limited liability. If I go broke, I lose everything. But if a corporation goes broke, the government protects it by virtue of saying you've got limited liability. You can only lose assets that are tied up in the corporation. And the partners in the corporation get to walk away free and clear.
Well, I mean, there are two things here. The first one is I agree with you. The government should not require power be given to your land until, you know, before you can build. If you want to build without power, that's your problem. I think government intervenes. Government intervenes in what we can and cannot do way too much, and regulates corporations and our individual lives way too much. Now, with regard to limited liability is a contractual agreement. When people take, when people lend money to a corporation, they know there's such a thing as limited liability. It's not withheld. It's priced into the market. That's how bonds and bank loans are priced to corporations. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. It's a voluntary transaction between shareholders.
So an artificial entity, which is a creation of the state, a corporation. A corporation is a creation of the state.
It's a creation of the market. It
no,
is a marketplace solution.
And the marketplace exists as a consequence of what? If there wasn't a court system, how could there be a marketplace?
Oh, I'm with you. I'm all for
If there wasn't a currency, how could there be a marketplace? Okay, so the marketplace is a creation of the state.
No, the marketplace is a creation of laws, of a rule of law.
And those laws came from?
Absolutely, but the state's job is not to regulate that marketplace. The state's job is to create the conditions.
The state's job is just to get out of the way and let the corporations have rights and powers and do whatever they want. And
whatever they want, as long as they don't violate my individual rights, as long as they don't pull out a gun, as long as they don't defraud me, let them do, as long as all the transactions are voluntary, they should be allowed to do what they want. Absolutely.
1-866-889-8894. We're talking with Dr. Yaron Brook, the executive director and president of the Ayn Rand Institute, founder of Ayn Rand, sort of the godmother of conservative economic thought in America these days. Let's see, line one, John in Alabama is on the line. Hey, John, welcome to the Tom Hartman program. You're on the air.
How you doing today?
Great. What's up?
I just wanted to ask one question to the doctor there. He's talking about deregulation and everything, right?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if he remembers when we had a president years ago, he heard the word deregulation in the trucking industry.
Yeah, that was Reagan, wasn't it?
No, that was Carter.
Carter, okay.
Carter, yeah. Carter. And that screwed everything right up. I mean, it really did, in the trucking industry anyways.
Yeah, I mean, well, see, this gets back to, I mean, here's the two sides of the argument, basically. Dr. Brook is saying that the market will take care of these things eventually. And I'm saying that if the government is acting on behalf of we the people, that the government, and it is we the people, it's not some, you know, alien force in the planet Theta, that government plays some role in these things, in making sure, you know, in saying, hey, it's a good thing for democracy for there to be a middle class, not for there to be a lot of desperately poor workers at Walmart and a whole lot of very wealthy corporate executives, and it's an okay thing for truckers to make an actual living wage, and you disagree with that, Dr. Brook.
The only thing that allows for middle class to exist is the jobs created by corporations and by businesses.
I disagree. I'd say that's one piece of it.
To the extent that government intervenes, the middle class is destroyed. In every country, in every experiment around the world, when you have capitalism, when you leave corporations and businessmen alone to create jobs, you get a middle class. When you have
Hang on just a second. Come on. I can't let that stand.
When the middle class goes away.
You're wrong. I mean, you're just wrong. I mean, look
I'm
at the countries
wrong.
Of Europe. They have, you know, people conservatives yell and scream that France and Italy and Spain, they're all socialist countries because they, you know, people have to have vacations and people have to have minimum wages and there's all this interference. Those are the countries that have middle classes.
They have middle classes, and their middle class live at a standard of living that is much lower than our middle class.
I lived in Germany for a year. Their middle class is, I think, much healthier than ours. The majority of people living in Germany have single worker incomes supporting families. I've been there. I go there three times a year.
I've been to Germany, too. I've been to Italy. I've been to France. I lived in Israel. I've lived in socialist countries. I know what this is like. The middle class lives at the low end of where the middle class in the United States live. We are 100 times better off than the Europeans are.
You're exaggerating wildly. John in Alabama,
opportunity to become not just middle class, but upper middle class, an opportunity that doesn't really exist in Europe.
Yeah, okay. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. We're talking with Dr. Yaron Brook, the president and executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. And Jan in Arcata, California, is on the line. Hey, Jan, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Great. What's up?
Well, I was listening, and I really had to call because the thing that's been getting me, I just can't believe the things that Dr. Brooke is saying.
Well, you're hearing the foundations of Reaganomics and Bushonomics. Oh, and, you
wish,
know,
I wish.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, they haven't gone as far as you'd like, I know,
no,
but they certainly have started down your road.
No, they're going in the opposite direction, in my view. But
the thing that I've found interesting is according to his logic there, it seems like if you take unemployment as the main factor, well, the time that the United States had the least unemployment was during the times of slavery. And I mean, if you really want to lower the wages,
no, but that's
that much,
ridiculous.
So
I'm not
job,
advocating for slavery.
You're
I'm advocating
going to
freedom.
Put yourself back into that position.
How is if somebody spends, Dr. Brooke, if somebody spends 100% of their income, and Jan, thanks for that. It was a good comment. If somebody spends 100% of their income on literally on just food and shelter, and they have no disposable income whatsoever, I mean, they're just barely getting by. How is that different from being a slave?
Oh, that's enormously different from being a slave. They're not forced to take a particular job. They're not beaten.
So they have the choice of living in the park.
And, by the way, they can get an education. They can get a better job. The fact is that under capitalism, when government is not involved, the standard of living rises, wages rise, quality of life rises, and the number of opportunities in terms of jobs increases dramatically.
I'm not an opponent of capitalism,
are not slaves. They have the option of switching jobs, of going somewhere else, of bettering their lives. Slaves do not have those options. Their rights are protected. The employer does not have a whip that he takes out and whip them into shape.
Okay, and you got a situation now where in some cities people have been looking for jobs for as much as 2 and 3 years.
Because today American corporations are not hiring as much as they would because the American government has created a situation in which it is expensive, cumbersome, difficult to hire employees. What we need is more deregulation, more elimination of some of these constraints to allow businesses to hire more people.
I see, yes. It sounds very nice and very clean, and I think it's absolute and utter nonsense, but
Andrew,
you know, I respectfully disagree. 1-866-889-8894. We're talking with Dr. Jan Brooke, the president and executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute, the fountainhead of objectivism. Israel in New York City is on the line.
Hi, Tom. Very informative programs you have.
Thank you.
Dr. Brooke, engineers that losing their job, what would you like them to train for? That's one question. And the second question is, a lot of jobs were losing to China. China, as you know, it's not a democratic country. Mm-hmm. China can decide tomorrow to go away with the American businessmen and transfer those industries that we're building there against us to war. We cannot do nothing about it because it's not a democracy. The people don't decide nothing in China.
I agree with you about China, and I've opposed the normalization of relationships, economic relationships with China. I think as long as that country is a dictatorship, a totalitarian regime, we should not be working with them, and I discourage American businesses from moving over there. I think long term, it's likely that their assets are going to be confiscated and that their intellectual property will be stolen.
As it already
I don't
has
think
happened.
It's an advantage to go to China. I think there are other countries like India, which I think what you as an engineer need to advocate is for more job creation, and the way you get more job creation is by freeing up businesses to grow and to develop and to
what kind of job,
the
Dr.
burden
Brooke?
On businesses in
well,
hiring.
If we take down all the protectionist barriers that we've had in the United States from 1774 up until basically Reagan, and really that Bill Clinton kicked out the doors with NAFTA and GATT, and now George Bush is not even enforcing treaties that we have. If we lower all these barriers, as Bush wants to do and as you're suggesting, what kind of job should this engineer in New York be training for?
Well, I think he will get a job as an engineer. I think the fact is that the pie grows all the time. There are plenty of jobs if industry is allowed to grow and is left alone.
But India has half a billion more people than we do.
The fact is that there are more jobs today in America, more jobs today in America than there were in 1970 or in 1975 or in 1960.
Yeah. Okay. On that point, I've got to ask you to hold. We've got to take a break here. I'm going to pot you both down. I'm sorry, Dr. Brook, and thank you, Israel, for your call. I appreciate that. This is Tom Hartman, it's 10 minutes before the hour. Stick around. We'll be back in just a minute.
They are delicious. Connoisseurs love them. They're imported from France. They're certified eco-friendly. And they're reasonably priced. What am I talking about? Eco Wines. One of the best-kept secrets in America, Eco Wines from the south of France. Brought to you since 1980 by my company, the Organic Wine Company. My name is Véronique. I select these earth-friendly wines personally. They are made with organic grapes. They burst with life and flavor. Our number? Easy to remember. 1-888-ECO-WINE. Our site? Easy to find. EcoWine.com. See, if you're going to eat, eat organic. If you're going to drink, drink wisely. Drink organic. Our future depends on it. Remember our number? 1-888-ECO-WINE. And that is ECOWINE.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics, Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Excuse me. Pardon me.
Slow down, Kyle. You'll choke on your coffee.
Can't. Have to finish getting the newsletter out before I can do anything else on my schedule today.
I used to have that problem before I discovered the Newsletter Factory.
Well, how'd they help you?
Their expert team of writers, editors, designers, and project coordinators do all my hard work for me. The Newsletter Factory even developed a readership survey that helped me produce the most appropriate content.
Sounds great, but I like doing some of the writing. It's just technical stories and layouts that bog me down.
No problem. In addition to turnkey projects, the Newsletter Factory gives you a smorgasbord of services from design and proofread to edit or full write. The Newsletter Factory can also help with printing and mailing. They keep you informed the whole way. Plus, the process is cost-effective and streamlined, so the Newsletter Factory doesn't have to compensate for lost time or mistakes.
Just like a factory.
Now you're catching on. Call the Newsletter Factory at 800-788-9550 to get started today, or visit them on the web at www.newsletterfactory.com.
I will, thanks.
Stories of courage need to be shared. That's why we want to tell you about Senators Bob Graham and Bill Nelson. They have stood strong to protect our coastlines from exploration and drilling by powerful oil and gas companies. But the fight's not over. Congress is now pushing an energy bill that still threatens our coastlines with oil and gas activities, hands billions of dollars in tax breaks over to the oil, gas, coal, and nuclear companies, and could exempt polluters from clean air and safe drinking water laws. What's more, this so-called energy bill doesn't cut our dangerous dependence on foreign oil, fix what's wrong with our aging energy grid, adequately promote renewable wind and solar power, protect consumers, or increase the efficiency or security of our energy system. There is a better way. Call Senators Graham and Nelson at 202-225-3121. Thank them for their courage and ask them to reject this dangerous energy bill. Paid for by the Florida Sierra Club.
The founding fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection: The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back, and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide, and you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection by Tom Hartman.
The best of the rest of the news. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is Tom Hartman, Tom Hartman Radio Program. We're talking with Dr. Yaron Brook of the Ayn Rand Institute. Dr. Brook, we got two calls. I'm Raymond in Cement City, Michigan, and Sean in Charleston. I'm going to give each one of them just 20, 30 seconds to make a point, and then I'm going to give you the last word and let you respond, if that's all right. Raymond, Cement City, Michigan, you're on. You got to be quick. Is that Ray? Oh, I'm sorry. That's Sean in Charleston. Hang on just a second.
Hey, how
Sean.
You doing?
Hey, Sean, you get to go first.
Great.
Fire away.
I think it's easy to get distracted, but what's obvious is people that are in charge of power and control and manufacturing and production. And, you know, I think it's just human nature to suppress, you know, others.
So you're saying that power in the corporate sector is as dangerous as power in the government sector. Is that
absolutely
the bottom line? Okay, great. Thanks. Moving along here, back to Raymond in Cement City, Michigan. Go ahead.
Yeah, quick question is, how does your economic system work when you put 1,000 people on a spaceship and tell them they have to survive for the rest of their lives together? And I think that that kind of is the extreme position of where we are on this planet with 6.3 billion people and growing and limited resources. So just go from there.
Yeah, okay, great. Isn't there some point, Dr. Brooks, at which we have to say, you know, there is a commons. We do have stuff in common. We have to attend to, and government does play an appropriate role in protecting that.
Well, my answer is no, and I'd add to that this argument about resources depletion and too many people on Earth has been made for at least the last 200 years. The population in the meantime has more than quadrupled, and I think people live better today on Earth, much, much better today on Earth than they did 200 years ago, in spite of the increased numbers. And the reason for that is, the reason we're so much better off today than we were 200 years ago is because of capitalism, is because of these corporations.
But right now, right now you have over a billion people who are going to bed hungry every night and are living literally on the edge of death. You know, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, there were only a billion people on Earth. How can you say
that's right? And many of them were starving. We just didn't have the statistics, and many of them were dying. And indeed, during the 15th century, the population of Europe, for example, halved because of disease. All of this has made the success in the last 200 years has been made possible because of capitalism.
Great. Okay, Dr. Brooks, thank you for being with us. I appreciate
it. Thank
you. Dr. Yaron Brook, President and Executive Director of the Ayn Rand Institute. This is Tom Hartman.
From the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Thank you.
For years, economists have defined the economic health of a country by its gross domestic product. Trouble is, every time a forest falls, the GDP goes up. With every oil spill, the GDP goes up. Every time a cancer patient is diagnosed, the GDP goes up. Is this how we measure economic progress? Economists must learn to subtract.
Here's today's Dal Bob Report. Sociologists often turn to infant mortality rates as an indicator of a country's well-being, and by this measure, we're slipping. For the first time in more than 40 years, the overall infant mortality rate increased from 6.8 deaths per 1,000 in 2001 to 7 such deaths in 2002. The Centers for Disease Control speculates women's decisions to have children later in life may account for the higher rate, though the CDC's report makes no mention of poverty, joblessness, or food insecurity.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
News break from the Minuteman News Service.
This is Don Waller in New York. The latest CNN USA Today Gallup survey of American voters finds Massachusetts Senator John Kerry leading George W. Bush among registered voters 50% to 45%, and among likely voters by 52% to 44%. A comparison of support for the two candidates by the results of the 2000 election show that among likely voters, Bush is barely ahead in the red states he won 4 years ago, leading Kerry by just 50 to 47%. In the blue states, which Al Gore won, Kerry leads Bush by a substantial margin, 55 to 42%. And in the purple states, where the margin of victory for either candidate in 2000 was 5 percentage points or less, Kerry also leads by a substantial range, 55 to 39%. Kerry's strength in recent polls has forced the Bush campaign to go negative a lot sooner in the campaign than they had expected. George W. Bush has taken to accusing John Kerry of flip-flopping on the campaign trail this week as his campaign moves quickly into negative territory. But a list making the rounds on the internet shows that Bush has done his share of about faces as well. A list first posted on the Daily Kos website points out that Bush has changed his mind on everything from the Department of Homeland Security and gay marriage to military benefits and the explanation for his mission accomplished banner. The list has broken through to the American media, illustrating how websites and blogs are changing the nature of political campaigns this year. Former UN Chief Weapons Inspector Hans Blix on Tuesday likened the run-up to the war on Iraq to a witch hunt and argued that the subsequent failure to find weapons of mass destruction would dent the public's faith in U.S. and British governments. Blix said that the intelligence information from the U.S. and other countries was exaggerated and that politicians should have asked more critical questions. Blix said that George W. Bush and Tony Blair were mistaken in their views, but he didn't think they acted in bad faith. More after this.
It won't happen to me.
There are 1 billion teenagers in the world today. That's 1 in 6 people. What if they don't know how or can't protect themselves against AIDS or unintended pregnancy? Help ensure people have access to the tools they need to build a healthy future. Visit www.populationaction.org. That's populationaction.org.
It happened to me.
A Georgia woman was caught trying to use a fake $1 million bill to buy $1,600 worth of merchandise at a Walmart and was later found with two more of the bills in her purse, police said. A clerk at the store immediately noticed the bill was fake when the woman handed it to her on Friday. The woman tried to use two gift cards with only $2.32 of value on them to buy the merchandise, but when that didn't work, she asked the clerk if she could cash the $1 million bill. For Minuteman News Service, this is Don Waller in New York.
Minuteman News Break is a production of TakeBackTheMedia.com.
Am I the only one who sometimes comes across a gut-wrenching, jaw-dropping story in the daily paper and then wonders, why did they bury this? Why isn't this the lead story on the front page? I had this reaction when I read a story with the deceptively bland headline of Modified Seeds Found Amid Unmodified Crops. Most people scanning the New York Times last month would either have missed this story entirely, since it was stuck down on the bottom of page 6 in section C, or simply would not have bothered to read beyond the boring headline. A better headline would have been, "Bioengineered Frankenfood Seeds Contaminating U.S. Food Supply," for that's what the story was about. It reported on new findings by the Union of Concerned Scientists, a respected group that recently ran systematic tests on the extent to which corporate-produced, genetically tampered seeds have gotten out of control and spread their altered DNA into previously uncontaminated seeds. The genetically modified organisms, engineered in the labs of such giants as Monsanto, range from potatoes that have pesticides built into them to vegetables that contain particular drugs. This test was of corn, canola, and soybean seeds that were not the bioengineered variety and supposedly would be pure, free of genetic alteration. The scientists found, however, that more than two-thirds of the 36 batches they tested contained traces of DNA from genetically engineered varieties, meaning that despite assurances from the companies and our lame government regulators, the engineered demon is loose. As one of the scientists put it, the door to seed contamination is wide open. Even more alarming is the blasé attitude of the contaminators. Rather than trying to protect the purity of our food supply, industry flacks say that the world should simply agree to, quote, acceptable levels of contamination. This is Jim Hightower saying, if that's unacceptable, call the scientists to get the story the media is burying. 617-547-5552.
I wonder who that is. What can I do you for?
A yodeler. That's one thing you don't want in your house. One thing you do want in your house is a sturdy, firm floor with Plytanium plywood from Georgia-Pacific. Floors made with Plytanium plywood are stiffer and more versatile than floors made with other subflooring materials. Plytanium plywood. Build it better.
When you hear how big businesses get all the best technology for the best price, does it make you crazy? To calm down, here's a thought from the voice of reason. Get a Xerox M15i. It's not just a digital copier printer that gives you 16 quality pages a minute. It also scans and faxes in color. All that and more for a $66 a month lease. Big business or small, what could be more reasonable?
Call 1-800-ASK-XEROX for business lease details. Toner and photoreceptor sold separately.
Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, friends. Broadcasting live on terrestrial radio stations. That is your standard regular radio station. These are industry words from coast to coast, streaming down from the depths of outer space on the Sirius satellite system. Now standard equipment on Chrysler, Ford, Jeep, Mercedes, Jaguar, on and on the list goes. And beaming around the planet on radiopower.org, our internet radio station, to literally tens of thousands of people in Shelby tells me now, over 100 countries regularly tuning in. This is the Tom Hartman radio program. Tom Hartman here with you, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. John R. Phillips has been called by the Wall Street Journal and the National Law Journal the nation's premier whistleblower attorney. That is, as in attorney for people who are whistleblowers. I find this fascinating. John has won a number of, I believe it's pronounced Key Tom. Is that right, John?
Yeah, that's correct.
Key Tom lawsuits brought by whistleblowers, including many Medicare fraud and defense contractor fraud cases, resulting in civil and criminal recoveries for the United States Treasury, totaling more than $2 billion. 1971, he co-founded the Center for Law and the Public Interest in Los Angeles. John, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Thank you, Tom.
I think it's great what you're doing here. It's interesting that
Yesterday, the House of Representatives passed this law, and I realize this isn't the realm that you're in, but yesterday they passed this law that would make it more difficult for individuals to sue corporations. Now, they picked out the arena of fast foods, but it's really part of a whole avalanche of laws designed to make it easier for corporations to operate and harder for individuals to claim harm. And I think that the whistleblowing is kind of on the edge of that whole thing, isn't it?
Yes, it is, in a sense. I mean, what the Congress was doing yesterday with the food and no lawsuits against food companies for obesity, and same thing they did with the gun industry, giving special immunity protection to them, and, you know, they even tried to do it with cigarette companies before. So
yeah.
But with respect to whistleblowers, though, I've got to tell you, there's a lot of support up there on both sides of the aisle for individuals like this who are willing to stand up and go against companies that have been cheating the government and defrauding the government out of, you know, lots of money. So thus far, with some exceptions, there's been good congressional support for this concept.
Now, let's differentiate it. There are whistleblowers within government, whistleblowers within companies who are defrauding government.
Right.
And then there are whistleblowers within their own companies who are alerting, for example, stockholders.
Right.
Or
Enron.
Yeah, for example. Are you dealing with both those issues or largely just the whistleblowers who are, pointing out fraud that is costing the government money?
Yes, just the latter. This is a statute, the False Claims Act, that is targeted against companies that have been defrauding the government, and it gives very special, unusual powers to individual citizens to go after those companies. And that's what my focus has been for the last 15 years.
Okay. When was the heyday of corrupt government contractors?
Well, you know, we've had corruption and contractors going way back to the founding of this country. In fact, in this book that author Henry Scammell writes about these cases, he has a quote right up front that goes like this: There's no kind of dishonesty into which otherwise good people more easily and frequently fall than that of defrauding the government. Now, that was spoken by Benjamin Franklin.
Yes. Okay.
At the founding of the country, and it's continued on from the beginning. This particular law that has been updated and utilized today was passed during the administration of Abraham Lincoln. In fact, it was sponsored by Abe Lincoln himself and is commonly referred to as Lincoln's Law.
Yeah, he was very concerned about government corruption among the defense contractors for the Civil War. It was a terrible and ongoing problem for him, according to Carl Sandburg's biography of him anyway.
That's true. And you had unscrupulous contractors, people dealing with the Union Army, selling them all sorts of shoddy products. In fact, that's where the name shoddy comes from, the material used to make uniforms for the Union Army that came apart whenever it rained or where there's too much stress, or cutting gunpowder with sawdust, selling the same horse to the cavalry two and three times. Lincoln said, we need to get something done here. They really didn't have an enforcement mechanism. There wasn't a Department of Justice in those days, so they enacted a very unusual law that gave the right to any citizen who knew about fraud against the government to essentially be deputized and bring an action for the government against the individual or the company that's cheating the government. And if successful, they gave them a percentage of whatever the Treasury got back. Back in those days, it was as high as 50%.
Whoa.
But the law worked, I think, around the Civil War era, but fell largely into disuse after the 1930s. Because of some restrictive court interpretations and unanticipated consequences of some legislative amendments.
Now we have a situation here where it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that whistleblowers nowadays are more likely to get nailed than to get paid. I mean, you see, Joe Wilson, he wasn't blowing the whistle on government fraud, but, you know, his wife gets outed as a CIA agent. And you hear the stories from some of these people who have been whistleblowers, and it's just absolutely mind-boggling. I mean, the persecution, in some cases actually prosecution that they undertake. What's life like for a whistleblower these days?
Well, it's always been tough, and it continues to be tough today. They get ground up by the system. I think America, on the whole, hasn't treated whistleblowers very well. You put so much at risk when you do this for yourself, professionally, for your family. Frequently, of course, if you rock the boat internally within a company and point out to some problem, you get fired and you get isolated. You find reemployment extremely difficult because you get blackballed in industries, and then you have no way of providing an income for your family, and you'll lose your house. The stress is so great that divorce is often in the mix here, and sometimes, even in extreme cases, suicide. So it's been a rough road to follow for these people who go down that road. But the good news for whistleblowers, to the extent there's been any good news, has been this law, the False Claims Act,
right,
that for the first time really gives them, it's an equalizer. It gives them power and gives them protection and gives them a real opportunity maybe to make a lot of money.
We're talking with John Phillips. He's the subject of a book by Henry, is it Scammell?
Scammell,
titled Giant Killers, the Team and the Law That Helped Whistleblowers Recover America's Stolen Billions. 1-866-889-8894 is our toll-free telephone number if you'd like to call in and be on the program. Dave in Humboldt County's on the line. Hey, Dave, welcome to the show.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. I think, one, that for sure we have to look at the fact that the government is not a victim in any of these arrangements, but a mutual willing co-conspirator. That is to say that it's been my direct first-hand experience that several of our most corrupt corporate entities that want to do business in a most disreputable fashion contribute big bucks, certainly to the Republican Party, sometimes to both parties.
So Halliburton, for example.
Well, in effect, what they're doing is buying the right to rip off the public, either through taxes or through defrauding their customers. They want to be able to do it unencumbered by government, and if they pay off the Republican Party, in this case, but usually both parties, then you cannot get any kind of government assistance at any point. The government has to turn their back and look the other way.
Yeah. Okay, and was there a question in there, Dave?
Well, I think, if I could put it in one, is there a... No, I don't think I can, but I would like to get a general discussion, because it sounds like people are exploiting the government, and if you think of that as not the government having their hand out to take the money that allows them to do it.
Okay, great. Let's bring this back around. Thank you, Dave. Let's bring this back around then, John Phillips, to what's going on right now. I mean, we've got Enron now has been charged with defrauding the government in at least three different investigations that I know of. You know, the $61 million for the fuel, the food services thing. I mean, apparently the subcontractor of the subcontractor that they hired to feed the troops hasn't even been paid for the plastic turkey that they handed George Bush for his photo opportunity, and they're grumbling and talking about suing Halliburton. I mean, is this the most corrupt administration in history? Is this, you know, what's going on here?
Well, I mean, with respect to Halliburton, they've been previously sued under this law and had to pay money back to the government, but this is a perfect example of how this law is intended to apply. When you have companies like that go over in those sort of unregulated circumstances where there's so much money pumped in a such short period of time that they often take advantage of the government, take much more than they're entitled to, and then they don't even deliver the services. And the hope is that no one's going to pay much attention to it, because unfortunately the government doesn't do a very good job protecting its own financial interests. That's the sad part of it. It's not, I mean, yes, in some occasions they're complicit in some of these machinations that result in the government coming out in the short end of the deal, but oftentimes they simply do not look after the funds that they spend and contracts that they let to make sure that they're delivered the goods that they were entitled to in a way that meets all the specifications and standards. And this law is the one that is really putting pressure on the government, because it gives the power of an individual who knows about fraud against the government to
bring a lawsuit, file it in federal district court, get a judge assigned, get an investigation launched, and you are there
make something
on behalf
happen.
Of the government.
Yeah.
So,
now, how did the Reagan administration produce a climate? I mean, it seems to me that so much of this stuff has come with the religion of conservatism. We just had a guy on from the Ayn Rand Institute saying government should, you know, completely get out of the way. And I'm sure he would be very upset with the kind of work that you're doing. Well, I shouldn't put words in his mouth. But in any case, how did the Reagan administration really set up this modern day government swindling operation that seems to have exploded in the last 20 years?
Well, I think in terms of the real problems of government fraud against the government really accelerated tremendously in the early 80s with the Reagan defense buildup, where they just pumped so many more billions of dollars into the defense industry.
Well, it was over $1 trillion, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. It was just an unbelievable amount of money. And, of course, here are these industries just having this money just being increased so substantially they couldn't figure out ways to spend it and accept it. So they made up a lot of stuff, and they just took the money but didn't perform the services. That's why Congress, actually, if you remember back at the time, was so outraged at the scandals stories that were coming out one after another, from $600 toilet seats to $800 rent.
Yeah, and they tried to do something. But we've got about 10 seconds left here, John. John Phillips, what's happening with the Bush administration on this, real quickly?
Well, they haven't been real supportive. In fact, they've tried to undercut some of these cases that we've brought by bringing the fox in the chicken coop, but it hasn't worked.
It hasn't. It's not working with the Bush administration. Surprise, surprise. John Phillips, thank you very much. Giant Killers is the book, The Team and the Law That Helped Whistleblowers Recover America's Stolen Billions. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
This is Tom Hartman. Stay tuned. We'll be back.
Trees in the eastern part of North America are on the
John,
menu
thanks for being
an
on the-
insect from eastern Asia. I'm Richard Hoops for Earthwatch Radio. The emerald ash borer somehow traveled from Asia to North America a few years ago, and today it's killing millions of trees in the eastern part of the Great Lakes Basin. The insect was discovered in Michigan 2 years ago, and it recently spread into Ontario, just across the Canadian border near Detroit. Ken Marchant is a forestry specialist with the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, and he does not mince words when talking about this insect.
It may be the worst forest pest to ever be introduced to North America. It has built up its populations amazingly quickly, and it's living up to its name as an invasive alien species. The populations build up extremely fast to damaging levels, and it has killed an estimated 7 million trees in southeastern Michigan, and it's infested probably a couple hundred thousand in Ontario.
The insect drills beneath the bark of the ash trees and destroys the vessels that carry water and nutrients up to the leaves and branches. Marchant says the emerald ash borer comes from cold parts of China and Russia, and it's well suited for its new home in North America.
It comes from an area that has a very extreme climate, and it comes over here pre-adapted to the climate. In fact, we'd probably think much of eastern North America was a tropical paradise, and the species of ash in eastern North America are very much to its liking.
Marchant says one of the only ways to control the emerald ash borer is to keep it from spreading. In Ontario, people are cutting down tens of thousands of ash trees, and they're hoping that the insect won't jump across that buffer zone. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Sea Grant Program and the Gaylord Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. A recent report prepared by the Democratic staff of the U.S. House Education and Workforce Committee hangs the most solid number yet on the hidden costs of shopping at Walmart. The committee figures each Walmart store with a staff of 200 or more puts a $420,750 burden on local federal taxpayers for social services costs. These would include housing, education, energy, and tax benefits awarded to workers like those at Walmart who are not paid a living wage and for the most part do not have health insurance. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. So-called free trade is losing support in the United States, and the loss has accelerated in the last 5 years, according to a comprehensive survey by the University of Maryland's Program on International Policy Attitudes. 53% of those polled want the U.S. to rethink its free trade policies in the light of the massive job loss it's created. And this year, the PIPA survey finds support collapsing rapidly as you move higher up the income ladder, a complete reversal from the norm.
Setting up a radio station? Wondering what software to use? Listen to the words of Mike Chandler of WOBS in Florida talking about the Tune Tracker system.
I love the software. I mean, it is rock solid. It has not burped one single time. This thing has not stopped. And I tell you, I've got some software that I run at two of my other radio stations that cost tons and tons more. One, I paid, I think, $1,500 for it. And then one system, which was the Arrakis DigiLink system, I paid $15,000 for it. But this rivals my $15,000 system.
As Mike Chandler said, the Tune Tracker system is rock solid. And the price? Only $349.95 for the pro version with traffic interface and only $149.95 for the original Tune Tracker 2. Either way, you'll have a radio automation like systems costing thousands more. For more information, go to our website, www.tunetrackersystems.com. www.tunetrackersystems.com.
Bringing you Uncommon Sense, you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Just got home from Illinois, locked the front door, oh boy. Got to sit down, take a rest on the porch. Imagination sets in, pretty soon I'm singing. Doo, 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 looking out my back door. This giant doing cartwheels, statue wearing high heels. Look at all the happy creatures dancing on the lawn.
And welcome back. It's Talk Radio for the rest of us. The Tom Hartman Radio Program. Uncommon Sense from the Radical Middle. Boy, did you see this thing I heard it on BBC Radio this morning. We released, I believe it was five folks. Maybe it was seven and five got out. Anyhow, we released a bunch of, five. Five, quote, terrorists. Actually, that's not the word that the U.S. government used to describe. What do they call them? Detainees. From Guantanamo Bay, where we have been holding them extra-constitutionally, that is to say, outside the realm of the Constitution. The excuse that this administration has been using for holding people without access to an attorney, without a trial, you come back here and look at the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed, which district shall have been previously ascertained by law, blah-de-blah-de-blah. And to be confronted by the witnesses facing him, to know the nature and cause of the accusation, and to have compulsory process for obtaining witness in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense. None of those things were provided to the people of Guantanamo Bay. And the government said, well, the reason that we can get away with that is because these are not people charged with a crime. These are enemy combatants, and they are not in the United States. They are in Cuba. Well, actually, in Guantanamo Bay, a piece of Cuba that we have kept, but we're not claiming that it's part of the United States, but we do control it. So it's this huge kind of gray area. And you've got now these guys got released and to England. They were Brits who were captured in Afghanistan, you know, during the initial invasion to throw out the Taliban, who is back, by the way, but that's a whole other thing. And the BBC, you know, delight at the release of Guantanamo men. Lawyers and families of the freed Guantanamo Bay detainees say they are absolutely delighted at the men's release from British custody. Now, here's what happened. We released them to England. England arrested them, talked to them for a day or so, said, these guys aren't criminals. They haven't committed any crime. They're in the wrong place at the wrong time. As it happened, apparently, to so many of these guys, they thought, let's go check out Islam. Where do you go for Islam? Well, the great Islam school is, you know, blah. Whatever. I mean, I'm not going to tell you their stories because I don't know them. But what I do know is that the British government has decided that they're not criminals and they let them go. So here you have people who aren't criminals who were held in jail for 2 years. And, you know, that in and of itself is concerning. But I think that there's a much larger concern here.
And wrong button here. And right after the break, I'm going to let a soldier, a member of the United States military, tell you in his own words what the problem is. And the bottom line is what's happening is we are recalibrating with these Bush doctrines, which violate the Constitution and violate 227 years of American history of preemptory war, going to war without first being attacked. Yes, Iraq did not attack us. Sorry, they had nothing to do with 9/11. George Bush himself said it. They did not attack us. And going to war against a country that has not attacked us is preemptory war. And this idea of enemy combatants being detained, what is this going to do to our soldiers in future combat and to the nature of warfare around the world? This is a very serious concern, a very serious concern for all Americans, particularly those who are in the military or who may have children who may end up in the military. 29 minutes past the hour. This is Tom Hartman, Truth in Broadcasting. Stay tuned. We'll be back.
What does corporate power have to do with disarmament? How does working for racial justice affect trade agreements? And what do they all have to do with the Cuban blockade? Having trouble making a connection? It's our specialty. The Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, for 88 years, connecting the issues for democracy and social justice. Why don't you connect with us? WILPF.org or call 215-563-7110.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
The Israeli government's running for cover over its decision to make Arab construction workers on the Knesset expansion project wear sniper-friendly markings on their hard hats. They were required to paint a giant red X on their helmets. Supervisors said the markings made it easier for security snipers to track their movements on the job site. But public backlash began when photos of the practice in action were published earlier this week. Aware of the symbolism of the discrimination on a construction project involving the parliament itself, the Knesset repealed the policy yesterday.
To date, 170 U.S. representatives and 31 senators have committed to supporting the Employee Free Choice Act, a bill that would establish stronger penalties for employers violating employees' right to join a union and allow employees to freely choose whether to form unions by a card check. The AFL-CIO is planning to make the EFCA a key issue in the 2004 elections.
This may be the year the state of Florida strengthens labor protections for migrant farm workers. A proposal making it a third-class felony to provide substandard working conditions was announced in the legislature this week. And unlike bills proposed last year to improve job conditions for farm workers, this proposal has the backing of Republican lawmakers. The legislation also calls for the creation of a commission to track working conditions in the state's ag industry. It sounds quite impressive, but it pales once you realize the maximum penalty suggested for a farmer mistreating workers is a $2,500 fine.
The FTAA may be skidding off track once again, with the Vice Minister of Brasilia announcing the Buenos Aires meetings are deadlocked over agricultural issues. Buenos Aires was going to set the agenda for the Trade Negotiation Committee meeting taking place next week in Puebla.
The European Court of Justice will consider penalties against the United Kingdom for failing to abide by common continental labor law enacted more than 4 years ago. The case involves Great Britain's failure to offer adequate break time to workers in contravention of the EU's Working Time Directive. British trade unions estimate more than 3 million white-collar workers alone are denied adequate breaks. Any adverse ruling might not amount to much, though. The UK has the option of opting out of EU labor law if it so chooses. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Is corporate greed primarily a male problem? According to Catalyst, a nonprofit group devoted to the promotion of women in business, it's hard to hide from the bottom line. It studied the stock performance of 353 Fortune 500 companies between 1996 and 2000 and found those with the highest proportion of women executives produced a 34% greater return to shareholders than the most male-dominated firms. Even so, only one in five executives at the most gender-diverse companies were female.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
the best of the rest of the news. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Now, Daddy didn't like trouble, but if it came along, everyone that knew him knew which side that he'd be on. He never was a hero for this town, he's shining light, but you could always find him standing up for what he thought was right.
And welcome back to the Vast Radical Middle Conspiracy. Take no imitations. This is the Tom Hartman Radio Program. And I realize I'm mixing wars here in a way, but in a way we're not. First of all, let's just be very clear about what George Bush said about 9/11 and Saddam Hussein.
We've had no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with the September the 11th.
No. We've had no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with September 11th.
We've had no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with the September the 11th.
No. No. Okay. Just to get that out of the way, because Dick Cheney keeps popping up and trying to string them together in sentences, even though, you know, it's... But now here, this is an American soldier, a young man by the name of Michael McPherson, and I would like you to listen very carefully to what he has to say.
When I invaded Iraq as part of the 24th Mechanized Infantry Division, I understood that the enemy was out to kill me, and my job was also to kill the enemy. This is what combatants do on the battlefield. This is what we are trained to do. I also understood that if I were captured, I would be at the mercy of my enemy. When I invaded Iraq...
Now that I would be at the mercy of my enemy, that's where it becomes critical. Now, keep in mind, every soldier, every American soldier all around the world has to be thinking like this.
I also understood that if I were captured, I would be at the mercy of my enemy. Being a prisoner of war is an experience to be avoided, but if captured, I hope to be treated in accordance with the Geneva Convention. I took comfort in my belief that the U.S. was dedicated to following the convention.
Now, as we have ever since its passage, frankly, I don't remember the year that it was passed, but it was in the last century. And the Geneva Convention specifically says you don't take prisoners of war and hold them without access to the Red Cross. You don't parade them in a way that would humiliate them, as we did with the photos of Saddam Hussein and his sons in time of war. You don't, and oddly, I mean, Bush is now saying, well, the Geneva Convention, blah, 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 this is why we shouldn't show the bodies of the returning vets from Iraq, although we can show the bodies of people at 9/11 in our campaign commercials. But I digress. Anyhow, he says he is a soldier. Hoped that he would be treated under the Geneva Convention. I'm going to repeat just that last little bit and continue with this.
I took comfort in my belief that the U.S. was dedicated to following the convention. At least that is what I was taught. Today's soldiers cannot take comfort in our treatment of POWs. In fact, they must wonder, if captured, if they will be treated as enemy combatants.
And see, that's the bottom line. I mean, this. Think of this. Think of this for our soldiers. I mean, this, the horrible thought that if one of our, we have soldiers now in over 120 nations who are involved in many in dozens of them in hot, you know, in combat, and up until the new Bush doctrine of no, constitutional rights, we don't need no stinking constitutional rights. Geneva Convention, Schmaneva Convention, we got this place in Guantanamo Bay, we're going to build a concentration camp down there. You know, Halliburton, by the way, built it. Did you know that Halliburton got the contract to build Gitmo, to build Camp X-Ray and Camp Delta? Anyhow, we've got our concentration camp down there. We know how to do this. We don't need no Geneva Convention. We're not going to let the Red Cross in. We're not going to let these people talk to anybody. No. And our soldiers all around, and this was opposed by our military,
Our soldiers all, and here's why, our soldiers all around the world are now saying to themselves, oh boy, if I get caught, am I going to be treated by the country that catches me the way that my country now treats our detainees, our prisoners of war? 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number. These and other issues. Chris in New Mexico is on the line. Hey, Chris, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Oh, hi, Tom. You're absolutely correct. We've given up the moral high ground in the Bush administration on so many things. I mean, no longer can the United States object to another power that we happen to be in combat with taking our soldiers and farming them out to other countries to be tortured for information.
Right. We've been doing that from the very beginning with Afghanistan. The Bush administration, of course, was the first to do this.
Yeah.
The Clinton administration was very careful about not doing that because they didn't want this to happen to our soldiers. When they
Absolutely.
Got into Serbia
Absolutely.
And Kosovo, I mean, it would have been very easy to send prisoners to Egypt and you know, let that dictator, Mubarak, you know, who always wins the elections that nobody opposes him in, it would have been very easy to send our prisoners over there and let him interrogate them. But we didn't.
Yeah.
But now we're doing that.
Of course, we're doing that.
We're sending them to Saudi Arabia for interrogation. We're sending them to Kuwait for interrogation.
You were talking about preemptive war, and that's one of the things that makes my gorge rise. I don't think that history is going to judge us as harshly on anything as it's going to judge us on the fact that we launched what the United Nations, you called it a preemptive war. The United Nations Charter calls it a war of aggression, and a great deal of the Charter of the United Nations was concerned with people launching wars of aggression. The fact that the United States never in its history had done this, and that it's the historic province of people like Adolf Hitler, who, you know, attacked Poland and attacked France and Czechoslovakia.
And Napoleon. And
used the excuse that there were terrorists there that were going to attack the German people. You know, a preemptive war or a war of aggression is an obscenity, and that was the basic reason that the Pope was not behind this, and all of the European countries were not behind this, because a war of aggression is an obscenity and something that we should not have lent ourselves to at all. I really think that of all the points that history is going to judge us harshly on throughout the George W. Bush administration, pray God it doesn't go very much longer, the fact that we launched a war of aggression is the worst.
Yeah, well said. Thank you, Chris. Thanks for your comments. 1-866-889-8894. This is a tragedy. It's a tragedy for the United States. And what amazes me is how many Americans just go, yahoo! You know, yeah, you know, bad guys, get them. Yeah, we liberated a country from a dictator. Well, number one, time will tell. I mean, we've stepped into We have kicked a hornet's nest here. And number two, okay, let's say that Iraq and the world are better off without Saddam Hussein. Let's just put that on the table and say that that's a given. It's a unipolar argument. It doesn't ask what's the other alternative, or what are the other alternatives. There are multiple other alternatives. You could have Saddam Hussein still in power and in a box. Yeah, it wouldn't be real nice for the Iraqi people. But the United States would still have nearly 600 young men and women alive who have died. And somewhere between 2,000 and 12,000 American GIs who would still have arms and legs and eyes who are missing those now. And we would still have a couple billion dollars that we have spent over there. I mean, we spent more in 12 months in Iraq than we spent in the last 2 years on all welfare programs in the United States, all public assistance programs. We spent the amount of money that we have spent in Iraq is just absolutely mind-boggling. I mean, you know, you think, what could we have done with this? What other things could have been done with that money? It's just remarkable. The politics of 9/11, by the way, is something that is worthy of getting into. And I want to get into this. Another talk show host has brought this out in a big way very recently. Let me just, first of all, let's take a call here. We've got Angelo in St. Petersburg patiently waiting on the line. Angelo, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I think the only thing that I could make an analogy to what the U.S. had done under the Bush administration was if we, let's say, go back to World War II and Japanese have a surprise attack against Pearl Harbor, and we unilaterally go to war with Spain because they had a fascist dictator running Spain at that time and totally obliterate Spain off the map and take Franco out of office, and, you know, consider that, oh, we have accomplished our mission. And to me, it's the same analogy.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. I mean, as George Bush himself just said on this program.
Precisely. And yet, in the average American mind, okay, and what has been, you know, pounded into our heads, you know, just ad endum for the last 6 months, has been the fact that, oh, we've whipped terrorism and we have done such a phenomenal job at solving this problem because we eliminated Saddam Hussein.
We have so far, Angelo, in Iraq, we have so far spent. Now, this isn't what we allocated. I mean, we've allocated over $170 billion for it, and the president, no money for Iraq in the current budget with its $500 billion deficit. So he's going to come back after the elections and ask for another $70, $80 billion. But so far, we have spent $105,654,713,000. I'm looking at a counter here, and it just keeps going. And that's enough. If we were to have spent that money in other ways, that's enough to have put 10,669,000 children through a year of the Head Start program in the United States, which would substantially improve their grades in school and their prospects of getting jobs when they get out of school. We could have, with that same money that we have spent so far in Iraq, paid for the medical expenses of 32,347,924 children for a full year. With the money that we have spent so far in Iraq, not just the money we've allocated, which is almost twice as much, but just the money we've spent so far, we could have hired, at current union salaries, 1,437,480 public school teachers for one full year. We could have, with the money that we have spent so far in Iraq, the $105,600,000,000, we could have given full 4-year scholarships at public universities to 1,914,210 young students in America. Can you imagine almost 2 million American students if we just said, okay, I mean, it's been 1 year that we've been spending this
just
money.
Take those funds that were allocated and use it here in the United States for programs we so desperately need, okay? The infrastructure in this country is deteriorating at an exponential rate, and yet, okay, we have to spend money to rebuild Iraq.
Yeah,
God help this country.
And we're going to provide them with single payer health care. You know, with the $105,654,000,000 that we have spent so far in Iraq, so much of it going through the hands of Halliburton and Bechtel,
absolutely,
we could have built 1,078,112 public housing units and given and said to people on public assistance, here's your house, you now own it, you now have the here's your bootstrap into the American middle class. Now that you've got the house, you know, get a job, you're not going to have to sleep in the shelter, and let's see you make that transition. And a lot of them would. I mean, we have done this before, back,
no,
you know, after
that.
The Civil after was it before the Civil War, you know, 40 acres no, after the Civil War, when they freed the slaves, 40 acres and a mule. Before that,
that's
anybody
correct.
Could lay claim to 100 acres of land out west if they wanted. We have done this before, and it has succeeded in helping to build America. Instead, we are spending this money and the lives of our young people in Iraq. And not only that, you consider, you know, we're cycling some over 200,000 young men over the course of a year. I mean, you know, they're doing a troop rotation now. It's 135,000 at a whack. Over 200,000 young men through that part of the world. And over a third of the veterans who served in Gulf War I are currently on disability. You know, because of exposure to the uranium, they call it depleted uranium. It's basically nuclear waste. I mean, it's made out of nuclear waste. It's a great way of getting rid of the nuclear waste from our power plants. And they
over $30 million was cut from the veterans' budget. Okay, when Bush first spoke about his support of our troops. Okay, and the first thing he did was turn around and cut $30 million from the veterans' benefits.
There you go. Well said, Angelo. Angelo, I got to move along. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894. Kurt in Seattle's on the line. Hey, Kurt, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Good morning, Tom. One thing is as gross an insanity is the many wasted. Not by the U.S., but by the Bush administration in Iraq, the greater obscenity is, where is the outcry? Why aren't they holding his feet to the fire?
Yeah, the Senate has, you know, I mean, they we've got this commission. Let's look into the intelligence failures. And, oh, no, we can't give them subpoena power. We can't do that, you know.
It's on and on down the list.
We can't really look into this stuff, you know. So, that's the real obscenity. You're absolutely right, Kurt. That is the real obscenity. 1-866-889-8894. Thanks for calling. This is the Tom Hartman radio program, 10 minutes before the hour.
Delicious. Connoisseurs love them. They're imported from France. They're certified eco-friendly. And they're reasonably priced. What am I talking about? Eco Wines. One of the best-kept secrets in America. Eco Wines from the south of France. Brought to you since 1980 by my company, the Organic Wine Company. My name is Véronique. I select these earth-friendly wines personally. They are made with organic grapes. They burst with life and flavor. Our number? Easy to remember. 1-888-ECO-WINE. Our site? Easy to find. EcoWine.com. See, if you're going to eat, eat organic. If you're going to drink, drink wisely. Drink organic. Our future depends on it. Remember our number? 1-888-ECO-WINE. And that is ECOWINE.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com. Or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Excuse me. Pardon me.
Slow down, Kyle. You'll choke on your coffee.
Can't. Have to finish getting the newsletter out before I can do anything else on my schedule today.
I used to have that problem before I discovered the Newsletter Factory.
Well, how'd they help you?
Their expert team of writers, editors, designers, and project coordinators do all my hard work for me. The Newsletter Factory even developed a readership survey that helped me produce the most appropriate content.
Sounds great, but I like doing some of the writing. It's just technical stories and layouts that bog me down.
No problem. In addition to turnkey projects, the Newsletter Factory gives you a smorgasbord of services from design and proofread to edit or full write. The Newsletter Factory can also help with printing and mailing. They keep you informed the whole way. Plus, the process is cost-effective and streamlined, so the Newsletter Factory doesn't have to compensate for lost time or mistakes.
Just like a factory.
Now you're catching on. Call the Newsletter Factory at 800-788-9550 to get started today. Or visit them on the web at www.newsletterfactory.com.
I will, thanks.
Hey, how you doing? Got a quick question.
Yeah?
Who was Rudolf Nureyev?
Rudy Nureyev.
Rudy.
Okay, I know this one.
Good.
Wasn't he a... Nureyev. Wasn't he a defenseman for the Maple Leafs?
Sure about that?
Could have been a goalie.
Yeah. Hey, how you doing? Who was Louis Armstrong?
That's easy. He was the first guy on the moon.
Really?
You know, one small step for man.
Sure, one giant leap for Louis. Hey, young lady.
Uh-huh.
Does the name Carlo Baggio mean anything to you?
Wasn't he the guy that went out with that mob guy's sister until he got whacked?
You know, no.
Are your kids as well-rounded as they could be? Kids who participate in the arts do better in school and in life. To learn more about the value of arts education, visit AmericansForTheArts.org. Because all kids should get to appreciate Nureyev's dance, Armstrong's horn, and Caravaggio's brush. Art. Ask for more. A public service message brought to you by Americans for the Arts and the Ad Council.
The Founding Fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The Founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide. And you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection by Tom Hartman.
Bringing you Uncommon Sense, you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the Real Free Speech Zone. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Several people have called in and asked Louise, who's been screening the calls here, if screening is the wrong word, because we let anybody through, but get their name and city they're from. Asked her, where did that Bush flip-flop list come from? And the email is rather long and confusing, and I'm not going to read it on the air, but the easy way to find it is you just go to Google and type Bush flip-flop into Google, and it comes up. It's the Daily Kos, or Kos, K-O-S, Daily Kos. It's a blog, and it's been reprinted in a whole bunch of other people's blogs. Bush is against campaign finance reform, then he's for it. He's against a Homeland Security Department, then he's for it. He's against a 9/11 commission, then he's for it. He's against an Iraqi weapons of mass destruction investigation, then he's for it. He's against nation building, then he's for it. Bush is against deficits, then he's for them. He's for free trade, then he's for tariffs on steel, then he's against them again. He's against the U.S. taking a role in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, then he pushes for a roadmap. And now he's kind of, well, who knows where he is. Bush is for states' rights to decide on gay marriage, then he's for changing the Constitution. Bush first says he'll provide money for first responders, police, fire, and emergency. Then he doesn't. Bush says that help is on the way to the military. Then he cuts benefits. Bush says, and I quote, "The most important thing for us is to find Osama bin Laden dead or alive," end quote. And then later he says, this is a news conference just this year, he says, or just this last year, he says, I don't know where he is, I have no idea, and I really don't care. Verbatim quote from George Bush. Bush claims to be in favor of the environment, and then secretly starts drilling on Padre Island. Bush talks about helping education and increases mandates while cutting funding. Bush first says the U.S. won't negotiate with North Korea. Now he will. And on it goes. Just type Bush flip-flops into Google. You'll find it. This is Tom Hartman, the real free speech zone.
Free to love the best of the worst. It's here they got the range and the machinery for change. And it's here they got the spiritual thirst. It's here the family is broken, and it's here the lonely say that the heart has got to open in a fundamental way. Democracy is coming to the USA.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Here's today's Daubab Report. Is corporate greed primarily a male problem? According to Catalyst, a nonprofit group devoted to the promotion of women in business, it's hard to hide from the bottom line. It studied the stock performance of 353 Fortune 500 companies between 1996 and 2000 and found those with the highest proportion of women executives produced a 34% greater return to shareholders than the most male-dominated firms. Even so, only one in five executives at the most gender-diverse companies were female. Here's today's Daubab Report. Some corporate executive perks have legendary status, like former GE chairman Jack Welch's post-retirement Manhattan apartment and Knicks tickets, or former Tyco CEO Dennis Kozlowski's Mediterranean birthday party for his wife, all on the company tab. But most executive perks go unnoticed, thanks to weak rules at the Securities and Exchange Commission, which allow companies to classify such spending as general unspecified business expenses, exempt from public disclosure.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
News break from the Minuteman News Service.
This is Don Waller in New York. The latest CNN USA Today Gallup survey of American voters finds Massachusetts Senator John Kerry leading George W. Bush among registered voters 50% to 45% and among likely voters by 52% to 44%. A comparison of support for the two candidates by the results of the 2000 election show that among likely voters, Bush is barely ahead in the red states he won 4 years ago, leading Kerry by just 50 to 47%. In the blue states, which Al Gore won, Kerry leads Bush by a substantial margin, 55 to 42%. And in the purple states, where the margin of victory for either candidate in 2000 was 5 percentage points or less, Kerry also leads by a substantial range, 55 to 39%. Kerry's strength in recent polls has forced the Bush campaign to go negative a lot sooner in the campaign than they had expected. George W. Bush has taken to accusing John Kerry of flip-flopping on the campaign trail this week as his campaign moves quickly into negative territory. But a list making the rounds on the internet shows that Bush has done his share of about-faces as well. A list first posted on the Daily Kos website points out that Bush has changed his mind on everything from the Department of Homeland Security and gay marriage to military benefits and the explanation for his mission accomplished banner. The list has broken through to the American media, illustrating how websites and blogs are changing the nature of political campaigns this year. Former UN Chief Weapons Inspector Hans Blix on Tuesday likened the run-up to the war on Iraq to a witch hunt and argued that the subsequent failure to find weapons of mass destruction would dent the public's faith in U.S. and British governments. Blix said that the intelligence information from the U.S. and other countries was exaggerated and that politicians should have asked more critical questions. Blix said that George W. Bush and Tony Blair were mistaken in their views, but he didn't think they acted in bad faith. More after this.
It won't happen,
goes on to say, is to learn from the past. The only way we can have a thorough examination of the past is with a cooperative government. Sadly, President Bush has been our biggest adversary in trying to find out what happened on 9/11. And after voting for him in the last election, I am gravely disappointed in his behavior in fighting this commission and their noble efforts to explain why we, as a nation, were so vulnerable to terrorism in 9/11. I look forward to your apology. Many thanks, Kristen Breitweiser. She goes on to say, as an aside, you failed to mention the following actual fact on your radio program. She's speaking to Mr. Limbaugh, that Mayor Giuliani, Police Commissioner Carrick, Fire Commissioner Von Essen, and 9/11 widow Dina Burkett were booked by the GOP to go on those shows. I, on the other hand, was booked by no one other than myself. Frankly, Mr. Limbaugh, I expected better from you. She's naive. She's expecting a right-wing talk show host to be honest, to have integrity, to not play with the facts. Well, you know, I have to say, I think at some level, I think these guys really believe that they are being honest and that they do have integrity, that there is truth to what they're saying. So transparent, the partisan agendas. And I suppose mine is, too, from time to time, although, well, anyway. The other one, the other 9/11 widow who was on TV that Limbaugh sought to attack on his program, Monica Gabriel. Dear Mr. Limbaugh, my name is Monica Gabriel. I was forwarded a transcript of your recent radio show. Plain and simple, I expect an apology for your false statements and erroneous accusations. In order to enlighten you, no Democratic or other party members schooled me or prepared my statements. To date, I have been quite capable of thinking for myself. Neither I nor the Family Steering Committee has received any funding from any person or organization. We are a completely nonpartisan, self-funded organization. We have worked tirelessly for over 2 years to have the facts surrounding the 9/11 attacks and the murder of my husband, along with 3,000 other innocent people, brought to light. Until we know why we, as a nation, were left so utterly exposed, we will remain at risk. In order to accomplish such a lofty goal, we need to thoroughly examine what protocols and procedures were in place prior to and on 9/11. We need to find out where the breakdowns occurred. Thus, all persons, both political parties, both past and present administrations, with any relevant knowledge, need to share what they knew when they knew it. Only then can we truly find when the failures occurred and correct them. Can we as a nation demand any less? Then she goes on to point out, sadly, in her letter to Limbaugh, sadly, President Bush and his administration have been staunchly opposed to any type of investigation into the murder of 3,000 innocent souls, not to mention the billions in property damage. This, to me, is unimaginable. Who wouldn't want to know why and how all our defensive postures failed so miserably on 9/11? Who wouldn't want to know that these flaws have been properly fixed? Who wants to have the same person and protocol in place today if it didn't work on 9/11? Who wants to be the victim's family's member speaking up the next time tragedy strikes? We, Monica Gabriel says to Rush Limbaugh, as citizens with the help of the 9/11 Independent Commission, have an opportunity to examine and hopefully correct the flaws which led to the horrors of 9/11. We need to seize this opportunity together to make us all safer and quell some of the nightmares. She wraps it up by saying, these are just a few of the issues which should have been debated on your program. More are available on our website, www.911independentcommission.org. She goes on to say, the attacking of 9/11 families with false, inflammatory statements is beneath even you. Unfortunately, it accomplishes nothing and serves only to avoid the real issues. I respectfully await your apology. And, you know, is it going to come, do you think? Is it possible? I don't know. Pretty unlikely, frankly, I think. We'll have our
Rush Limbaugh theme music for that right after this call. We've got Steve in Santa Fe on the line. Hey, Steve, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Howdy, Tom. Can you hear me?
I can. You're live and on the air.
I had problems a little bit ago. Yeah, I was pretty disgusted with the whole concept of using ads, 911. But I was thinking that the GOP should just go ahead and make it their own little special day. You know, have party hats and stuff like that.
Well, they're going to. They're gonna do it in New York the week before 9/11. I mean, they are gonna make it their special day, and they are gonna have their little party hats and their lobbyists giving them millions and yeah.
Yeah, but they should just go ahead and declare it that it's their day, and it didn't affect anybody else. It's and they're the ones that, well, you know, were great about it. They should just go ahead and declare it.
Yeah, well, I think they have, Steve.
Mm-hmm.
I think they have. I mean, you know, what's the next step after that? You know, to say that anybody else who speaks about it must be, as the Wall Street Journal said yesterday, are they all neutral innocents as depicted, or are they part of an organized anti-Bush opposition? Yeah.
Yeah, I saw some of that junk on Hannity and Combs last night, that ridiculous show we watched every once in a while, but they were going on that same angle that it was all orchestrated and how the media wasn't reported how orchestrated it was. It's kind of sick, but you know, that's what you get with them, I guess.
Yeah, well, you know, it's this is the right-wing talk machine. You know, it starts with Limbaugh, and then it goes to the Wall Street Journal, and then it goes to Hannity, and then it goes to, you know, and it goes on down, it echoes on down the list. You know, some 300 hours a day of right-wing radio programming in the United States, not to mention the dozens of hours, well over a dozen anyway, I guess you could say two dozen, 24 hours a day of right-wing programming on faux news, and so that's all we can expect. Steve, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. 20 minutes past the hour. This is Tom Hartman, moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. Stay tuned.
People in Africa who live near great apes might find that their own prosperity is tied to that of their neighborhood primates. I'm Richard Hoops for Earthwatch Radio. International research groups have been working hard to protect the great apes of Africa, but their efforts have had limited success. Almost all populations of these primates are declining. A UN conservation expert says solving problems for the animals means dealing with the poverty of people who live nearby. Some researchers say 90% of the habitat for great apes will be degraded in some way within the next 25 years. In Africa, the landscape is being torn up by roads that are built for mining and logging operations, and illegal poaching of apes adds to the problem. Ian Redmond is a tropical field biologist and conservationist, and he's worked at the Karasoki Research Center in Rwanda. He says habitats for great apes are in some of the poorest parts of the world. He says poverty often forces people to work for the mining and logging companies or to poach to feed their families. He says people need alternatives to ensure their own well-being and that of the neighboring wildlife.
And you can't help someone lift themselves out of poverty by encouraging them to destroy their environment because their kids weren't thankers. You know, maybe the parents will get a job for a few years that depends on destroying the environment, but if it's not sustainable, then the long-term result will be a negative one.
Redmond says successful projects like the Rwanda Research Center are designed to reduce poverty. He says the Karasoki Project has employed many local residents for their entire adult lives. Money from guerrilla tourism and other conservation efforts is returned to the community to build clinics, schools, and water systems. Redmond says that's made the project part of the local culture, and it offers a daily reminder of the benefits that can follow these kinds of conservation projects. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Sea Grant Program and the Gaylord Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin.
Here's today's Dal Bob Report. With drug prices so much lower, it's no wonder America's seniors are getting on the bus and heading to Canada. Though it's technically illegal under FDA rules, senior citizens groups from northern states now routinely charter buses to Canadian pharmacies. Lawmakers in Ottawa created the patented Medicines Prices Review Board to bargain for lower prescription drug costs, and as a result, Canadians pay 30 to 70% less than U.S. citizens. Here's today's Dal Bob Report.
A series of tax breaks for wealthy Americans and a ballooning military budget has the federal government running a record deficit. What to do? If you're Alan Greenspan, try cutting Social Security benefits. 3 years ago, the chairman of the Federal Reserve told Congress that tax cuts wouldn't endanger Social Security benefits. Fast forward to last week when the Fed chief asked Congress to reduce the cost of living increases in Social Security checks. Greenspan also proposed rolling back the retirement age to 67 years old.
Stories of courage need to be shared. That's why we want to tell you about Senators Bob Graham and Bill Nelson. They have stood strong to protect our coastlines from exploration and drilling by powerful oil and gas companies. But the fight's not over. Congress is now pushing an energy bill that still threatens our coastlines with oil and gas activities, hands billions of dollars in tax breaks over to the oil, gas, coal, and nuclear companies, and could exempt polluters from clean air and safe drinking water laws. What's more, this so-called energy bill doesn't cut our dangerous dependence on foreign oil, fix what's wrong with our aging energy grid, adequately promote renewable wind and solar power, protect consumers, or increase the efficiency or security of our energy system. There is a better way. Call Senators Graham and Nelson at 202-225-3121. Thank them for their courage and ask them to reject this dangerous energy bill. Paid for by the Florida.
The best of the rest of the news. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Ladies and gentlemen, Rush Limbaugh.
They say that I'm sleaze and elitist. You please, everybody disagrees with my rap. It's rap. I'm horrendous. I'm appalling. My ratings now are falling because I'm so full of bull, so full of crap. With condescending cries, making money, selling lies. You might say, everybody hates my guts. I'm offensive, I'm a bigot, I'm a fraud. Can you dig it? I'm a sexist, racist, homophobic, fat, pathetic, putz.
I'm a Nazi.
That's right.
I really am.
Because I'm a Nazi.
That's right.
You're being scammed.
I'm a Nazi. I don't care about the middle class because I'm a fat conservative, but and with a face of a horse's.
Ah, yes. Welcome back. It's the official Rush Limbaugh song there. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman radio program. 25 minutes past the hour. And yes, it's been a long time. I try not to mention other talk show hosts on this program, but boy, going over the top, accusing the widows of 9/11 victims of being part of an organized political partisan smear campaign against the president, when in fact nothing, it's not even remotely the case. And then, you know, triggering this whole, it's beyond the pale. Well, the presidential prayer team is at it. If you're on the Republican mailing lists, as many of us are, here we get this, the presidential, if you're a member of the presidential prayer team, you just got this email. Pray for the president as he seeks wisdom on how to legally codify the definition of marriage. Pray that it will be according to biblical principles. With many forces insisting on variant definitions of marriage, pray that God's word and his standards will be honored by our government. Well, okay. Well, let's look Genesis 29:17 and 2 Samuel 3:2-5. Marriage is a man and a woman. Okay. 2 Samuel 5:13, 1 Kings 11:3, 2 Chronicles 11:22. Marriage shall not impede a man's right to take concubines in addition to his wives. Well, how about Deuteronomy 22:13? A marriage shall be considered valid only if the wife is a virgin. If the wife is not a virgin, she shall be executed. Yeah, biblical principles. Genesis 24:3, Numbers 25:1, Ezra 9:12, Nehemiah 10:30. Marriage of a believer and a non-believer shall be forbidden. Now, you know, biblical principles for marriage. Coming from the president's prayer group. How about Deuteronomy 22:19 and Mark 10:9? Since marriage is for life, neither this Constitution nor the Constitution of any state, nor any state nor federal law, shall be construed to permit divorce. And, of course, who could forget Genesis 28, 6 through 10, and Deuteronomy 25, 5 through 10. If a married man dies without children, his brother shall marry the widow. If he refuses to marry his brother's widow or deliberately does not give her children, he shall pay a fine of one shoe. These are real biblical principles for marriage. I mean, you know, it's an institution. It's always been this way. Yes, okay. Let's go back to it, the conservatives say. Let's repeal that 1967 law, too, that said the people of different races can't marry. I mean, that was based on the Bible, Numbers 25, 1 through 19, Ezra 9, 12, Genesis 24, 3, Nehemiah 10, 30, that people of different religions can't marry. You know, come on. This is a civil rights issue, my friends. This is simply an extension of civil rights. You got somewhere between 3 and 10% of the population who are gay. They should have the right to get married just like everybody else. It's just, I mean, this is not rocket science, and it's not going to destroy the institution of marriage. It is going to strengthen it, if anything. Mark my words. 29 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our number 866-889-8894, if you'd like to call in and be on the program. Going to get into some issues about privacy here, and a new way hospitals have figured out to cut costs. Stick around. I'll be right back.
Have you visited 100fires.com lately? If not, then you're missing out on thousands of books for a better world. Books about how you can make a difference, about the rights of workers, creating more livable communities, and about how we can stop large corporations from destroying our democracy. 100fires.com offers secure ordering, full searchability, gift certificates, and much, much more. That's 100fires.com. Books for a better world.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
The Israeli government's running for cover over its decision to make Arab construction workers on the Knesset expansion project wear sniper-friendly markings on their hard hats. They were required to paint a giant red X on their helmets. Supervisors said the markings made it easier for security snipers to track their movements on the job site. But public backlash began when photos of the practice in action were published earlier this week. Aware of the symbolism of the discrimination on a construction project involving the parliament itself, the Knesset repealed the policy yesterday.
To date, 170 U.S. representatives and 31 senators have committed to supporting the Employee Free Choice Act, a bill that would establish stronger penalties for employers violating employees' right to join a union and allow employees to freely choose whether to form unions by a card check. The AFL-CIO is planning to make the EFCA a key issue in the 2004 elections.
This may be the year the state of Florida strengthens labor protections for migrant farm workers. A proposal making it a third-class felony to provide substandard working conditions was announced in the legislature this week. And unlike bills proposed last year to improve job conditions for farm workers, this proposal has the backing of Republican lawmakers. The legislation also calls for the creation of a commission to track working conditions in the state's ag industry. It sounds quite impressive, but it pales once you realize the maximum penalty suggested for a farmer mistreating workers is a $2,500 fine.
The FTAA may be skidding off track once again, with the Vice Minister of Brasilia announcing the Buenos Aires meetings are deadlocked over agricultural issues. Buenos Aires was going to set the agenda for the Trade Negotiation Committee meeting taking place next week in Puebla.
The European Court of Justice will consider penalties against the United Kingdom for failing to abide by common continental labor law enacted more than 4 years ago. The case involves Great Britain's failure to offer adequate break time to workers in contravention of the EU's working time directive. British trade unions estimate more than 3 million white-collar workers alone are denied adequate breaks. Any adverse ruling might not amount to much, though. The UK has the option of opting out of EU labor law if it so chooses. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Is corporate greed primarily a male problem? According to Catalyst, a nonprofit group devoted to the promotion of women in business, it's hard to hide from the bottom line. It studied the stock performance of 353 Fortune 500 companies between 1996 and 2000 and found those with the highest proportion of women executives produced a 34% greater return to shareholders than the most male-dominated firms. Even so, only one in five executives at the most gender-diverse companies were female.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Bringing you uncommon sense, you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Robin Bush and his merry band ripped apart this happy land. It's Robin Hood with a switch. He steals from the poor and gives to the rich. The Bushies and the Foxies and the prehistoric Limbaugh. We had a huge surplus and it's gone. We'll be running huge deficits from now on. There are big tax refunds for a few. The rich get richer and the poor get screwed. Robin Bush and his merry band.
Yeah, Robin Bush and his merry band. As you heard in our first hour today, if you've been listening for the through the whole show, the conservative agenda. Get while the getting's good, guys. William Safire. William Safire is one of those few conservatives for whom I still have some shred of respect. Him and William F. Buckley. I mean, I believe they're wrong on most issues, and Safire has on more than one occasion, I think, basically kind of pimped for the Republican Party. But more often than not, he's out there saying what he thinks is true, and right or wrong. And here's a column that he wrote yesterday in the Wall Street Journal, raising some very serious questions, very, very serious issues. And it, from a concern, this is one of the reasons why I wonder if maybe Louise is right that Bush is not going to get reelected, because you've got conservative Republicans raising these issues about the kind of damage that the Bush administration is doing, not only to our credibility around the world, not only to our environment, not only to our economy, but to our Constitution. 1-866-888-9894 is our number, by the way. William Safire, he starts this column up by quoting George W. Bush a month before the election as a candidate. George W. Bush says, and I quote, "I believe privacy is a fundamental right that every American should have absolute control over his or her personal information." Well, that sounds good. Interestingly, we could do a whole program on this someday, but Clarence Thomas in the Texas sodomy case said he could find no right to privacy in the Constitution. Clarence Thomas, the guy that George W. Bush says is his model. His model for future Supreme Court nominees, Clarence Thomas and Antonin Scalia. Bush is on record as saying, these are the guys, I want to have more like them. And Thomas in the Texas sodomy case came right out and said, "I can find no right of privacy in the Constitution." Now, he was quoting a previous justice who I believe was named either Potter or, I don't think it was Potter Stewart, maybe it was. The two names are sticking in my head. Anyhow, back in a 1960s case, 63 or 65, which was Connecticut versus Planned Parenthood or something similar to that. I'm sorry, I'm flying on memory here. And in which I believe it was Planned Parenthood, was challenging the laws of the state of Connecticut that made it a felony for a pharmacist to sell birth control devices to married couples. and made it a felony for married couples to own birth control devices, whether they were pills or condoms or diaphragms, to own them or to use them in the privacy of their own bedrooms. And the Supreme Court struck down that law about the same time that birth control pills came along. This was in the early 60s. And that led to what many people called the sexual revolution. Suddenly it was you could have sex without worrying about pregnancy. And, you know, the rest is history, I guess. But here you have this one of the Supreme Court justices in that case saying there is no right to privacy in the Constitution. It doesn't exist. The word privacy does not exist in the Constitution. And then you got Clarence Thomas now just last year in the Texas sodomy case saying the same thing. In fact, quoting that decision from the 1960s in the Connecticut birth control case. Now, could it be that there is no right to privacy in the Constitution? I mean, if the founders believed in a right to privacy, why didn't they say it? Let me read you the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment is the one that in Roe v. Wade in 1973, the question before the court was, do women have actually three questions. Number one, do women have constitutional rights? Because in 1873, 100 years before, in Ferguson versus, Sarah Bradwell versus the state of Illinois, in 1873, the Supreme Court had ruled that women only derived constitutional rights through their husbands or fathers. Sarah Bradwell had gone off and gotten a law degree. She'd become a lawyer. And she showed up in court in Chicago, 1871, to practice law. And the judge looked down from the bench and told her that she was a woman. And she said she realized that. And he said he was not going to allow a woman to practice law in his court. And he threw her out. And she sued. And it went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said, 1873, Bradwell versus State, the Supreme Court said that the supreme purpose of a woman was to be a wife and mother, and that she must be subordinate to her husband or father, and that she could only derive constitutional rights through them. So this came back to the court in 1973, 100 years later. I mean, remember, in 1896, the court said basically the same thing about African Americans, that they, you know, in Plessy versus Ferguson, separate but equal. Yeah, they have rights, but... And in 1954, the Supreme Court in Brown versus Board of Education overturned that. So now in 1973, the Supreme Court is deciding whether or not to overturn Bradwell versus State and grant constitutional rights to women. So that was the first question. Should women have constitutional rights? The second question was, if they should have those rights, is the right to privacy included in the Constitution? If it is, should they have the right to privacy? And number three, the third question was, is a woman's choice to have an abortion or not to have an abortion considered something that would be fall into the realm of privacy? But the main issue of Roe v. Wade, and the reason why it hasn't been overturned up until now, is because the main question was, are women entitled to the same rights of privacy under the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution as men are? Now we have Justice Clarence Thomas saying last year in the Texas sodomy case, in his dissent in the case, in writing, and I quote, "I can find no right to privacy enshrined in the Constitution," end quote. So let's read the Fourth Amendment. I just want to, you know, this is so important. "No person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment..." I'm sorry, that's the Fifth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment. "The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized." Now, that's a very clear definition of a right to privacy. I think we can all agree on that, and the Supreme Court certainly has agreed on that. Recently, since 1973. But why did they say the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects instead of saying the right of the people to have privacy? Well, it turns out there's a reason why Madison and Mason, who were the primary authors of the Bill of Rights, and Jefferson, who was goading them on and editing with them by long distance from France, why these three men did not use the word privacy in 1787 when the Bill of Rights was written. The reason why is because in 1787, privacy meant toilet functions. If somebody said, I need some privacy, it meant they were going to use the bathroom, what we would call the bathroom, the toilet, the loo. It's where the word privy came from. They used to, you know, when outhouses came along, they were called privies. And the founders didn't think it was necessary to write into the Constitution the right to use the bathroom. They figured everybody knew we have that right. The Ninth Amendment covers it. The Ninth Amendment, which basically says, the enumeration of the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others obtained by the people. In other words, anything we didn't name here doesn't mean that it's not a right that people have. So the right to privacy is in the Constitution, and it is explicit. It's just that they don't use the word privacy because in the 227 years from the time the Constitution was written until today, I mean, it was in the word privacy has changed its meaning. It was in the late, as I recall, it was either the mid or the late 1800s that Thomas Crapper in London invented the flush toilet. And people stopped calling it the privy and started calling it the crapper. And you know, and our language has cleaned up since then. But, I mean, this is the evolution of the English language. So there is a right to privacy. So back to William Safire. William Safire says, I believe privacy is a fundamental right. He quotes Bush. I believe privacy is a fundamental right and that every American should have absolute control over his or her personal information. And then he goes on to say, last week the Justice Department said that medical patients, and now he quotes from the Justice Department, no longer possess a reasonable expectation that their histories will remain completely confidential, end quote. He points out, this by William Safire, the Justice Department issued subpoenas to hospitals in several cities across the nation for the medical records of hundreds of women who had undergone abortions. He ends up by saying it's proper for a doctor to report a case of spousal or child abuse to the police, but then he goes on to say, but how do patients feel about their doctors first secretly calling the FBI? Where is the oversight to protect the innocent, injured, or ill? Where is patients' informed consent? And I would add, where is the right to privacy? This administration is shredding, my friends, the Constitution of the United States of America. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And Sheila in Denver's on the line. Hey, Sheila, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hi, how are you today?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you?
I'm good, good, good. I heard you say just a moment ago that there's a chance that Bush might not win the election. I hope and pray you're right. My question is, do you think there's enough, or do you think there will be enough votes to outweigh the certain election fraud that no doubt will occur? The Bush crime family will commit it again. Do you think there's enough votes to outweigh that?
You know, I don't. My wife does. So there, reasonable people disagree. Frankly, the voter fraud, which is starting to become an issue now, I think is getting enough visibility that maybe they won't be able to get away with it. And frankly, I don't think it's a big organized thing. I think the real risk with these electronic voting machines is independent programmers who go off on their own high horses, who have their own political agendas. But who knows? I mean, nothing would surprise me anymore after they're pulling 90,000 people off the voting rolls in Florida in order to clean up the rolls in preparation for the 2000 election, and then keeping them that way for the 2002 election so Jeb could be sure that he got reelected. Florida's like a banana republic, and this is what the Bush family brings us. Yeah, but on the other hand, the thing that concerns me, frankly, more than that, is the war chest this guy's got. I mean, you know, he drops into a city, he gives a 20-minute speech, and he collects $1 million from representatives of big industries. And that, I think, is, I mean, don't underestimate the power of advertising. That's my thought, that with advertising, you actually can change people's minds. It's the reason why people advertise. And Bush has so many millions of dollars more than Kerry, and probably will right up until the day of the election, that I personally suspect he's going to get reelected.
Yeah, I wish we could make a change, but I don't mean to criticize you, but I never use the word reelected because a man was never reelected.
You're right, and I've been trying to break that habit. Thank you.
Thank you.
Elected for the first time, yeah, because he was selected the first time. You're welcome, Sheila, and thank you very much for calling. It's great to hear from you. And now, on. Yeah, Louise makes the point. Don't underestimate how upset people are. I don't, and I am one of them. And I don't, you know, I don't think gratuitous anger on the radio is necessarily the solution. We need to be waking people up and educating them. So, Wall Street Journal story yesterday, front page, unlikely. Here's the headline. This article by Gautam Naik. Unlikely way to cut hospital costs. Comfort the dying. And what are they doing now for seriously sick people? They are setting them in situations where they can be comfortable, but they no longer get medical care other than painkillers. The Wall Street Journal says it's all part of an approach that has helped VCU, this one hospital, save millions of dollars in an area that is notoriously expensive, treatment of patients diagnosed with incurable illnesses. Palliative care focuses on comfort, not cure. Interesting. 1-866-889-8894. Tom in North Carolina is on the line. Hey, Tom, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
To give that lady who just called just a little bit of a hope to grasp onto, Alex Keaton is...
I don't.
He was a character on Family Ties, you know, Michael J. Fox.
Yeah, I didn't, you know, actually I didn't have a TV for a lot of years, and I never saw the show.
Okay, well, he was sort of a young yuppie.
Yeah, about 5 seconds here, Tom.
Okay, and my son voted for George Bush against Bill Clinton, Bob Dole against Bill Clinton.
Tom, I'm going to ask you to hold on over the break, if you can just hang on there. We'll be right back. This is Tom Hartman, 10 minutes to.
Grapes are one of the most heavily sprayed of all agricultural products? Most people don't. But that is why it's so very important to drink wines that are made with certified organic grapes. And that is exactly what we are inviting you to do today. Taste our wines. We select them personally. They come from small properties in the south of France. They are delicious. Connoisseurs love them. And they are earth-friendly. My name is Véronique. I founded the Organic Wine Company in 1980 for people just like you. People who love wine and want to do well by our earth. Call us at 1-888-ECO-WINE. We'll answer all your questions. I look forward to talking with you. Call 1-888-ECO-WINE, and that is ECOWINE.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates block out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Excuse me. Pardon me.
Slow down, Kyle. You'll choke on your coffee.
Can't. I have to finish getting the newsletter out before I can do anything else on my schedule today.
I used to have that problem before I discovered the Newsletter Factory.
Well, how'd they help you?
Their expert team of writers, editors, designers, and project coordinators do all my hard work for me. The Newsletter Factory even developed a readership survey that helped me produce the most appropriate content.
Sounds great, but I like doing some of the writing. It's just technical stories and layouts that bog me down.
No problem. In addition to turnkey projects, the Newsletter Factory gives you a smorgasbord of services from design and proofread to edit or full write. The Newsletter Factory can also help with printing and mailing. They keep you informed the whole way. Plus, the process is cost-effective and streamlined, so the Newsletter Factory doesn't have to compensate for lost time or mistakes.
Just like a factory.
Now you're catching on. Call the Newsletter Factory at 800-788-9550 to get started today. Or visit them on the web at www.newsletterfactory.com.
I will, thanks.
Setting up a radio station? Wondering what software to use? Listen to the words of Mike Chandler of WOBS in Florida talking about the Tune Tracker system.
I love the software. I mean, it is rock solid. It has not burped one single time. This thing has not stopped. And I tell you, I've got some software that I run at two of my other radio stations that cost tons and tons more. One I paid, I think, $1,500 for it. And then one system, which was the Arrakis Digilink system, I paid $15,000 for it. But this rivals my $15,000 system.
As Mike Chandler said, the Tune Tracker system is rock solid. And the price? Only $349.95 for the pro version with traffic interface and only $149.95 for the original Tune Tracker 2. Either way, you'll have a radio automation system that performs like systems costing thousands more. For more information, go to our website, www.tunetrackersystems.com. www.tunetrackersystems.com.
The Founding Fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The Founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection: The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide. And you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection by Tom Hartman.
Bringing you uncommon sense, you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the place where smart people get their news. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We were talking to Tom in North Carolina before we were so rudely interrupted by the need for us and our radio stations to actually earn a living here. Tom, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, Tom. I'm in a loyal Democratic family, but my son, who lives in Chapel Hill, which is the most liberal spot in the state, voted for George Bush when he ran against Bill Clinton, and he voted for Bob Dole when he ran against Bill Clinton. He also voted for George Bush when he ran against Al Gore. But the last time he came home for a visit, he had a sticker on his bumper that said, "Anybody but Bush."
Yeah, there's some family up the street from us has got a lawn sign out that says, "Somebody else," ELSE in big letters, "for president." But it's been up for a couple of months. Well, that's good news, Tom. Thanks for sharing that. That's great. I appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894. Armin in Florida is on the line. Hey, Armin, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Everybody want to sing along with me? The conservative liberal media has a new diversion now.
What's that?
A Democratic spy.
Say what?
Oh, they claim they got a Democratic spy that was working for the behalf of Iraq.
I don't understand.
It's a new breaking story.
Oh.
One of the senator's aides was a spy for Iraq. A Democratic senator's aide was a spy for Iraq.
Oh, you're kidding.
So you need to sing along and forget about the Democrats spying on the Republicans and Frist. I mean, excuse me, the Republicans spying on the Democrats, Bill
right.
Frist.
Bill Frist and his Manuel Noriega, or not Noriega, Miranda.
And we're supposed to forget about all the Bush crime family's financial ties to Saddam Hussein and all that illegal acts that they were doing.
Yeah.
Where's the investigations for all that?
Yeah. Well, they're moving slowly, and maybe after November something will happen. Yeah, that's a possibility. Thanks for that there, Armin. I'm sure we'll catch that on the news when I get off the air. I appreciate your calling. 1-866-889-8894. The day has ended. Thanks to Brad Walrod for selecting and editing our music in New York City. Thanks to Louise for producing a great show. Thanks to the folks in our chat room for showing up. It's always great to have you there. Thanks to the radio stations who carry us and to Sirius Satellite folks. And thanks to you for listening. Be sure to join us again tomorrow, same time, same place. This is Tom Hartman. I'll see you then.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Layoffs usually focus on those who go unemployed, but those left behind also pay a price in their health. Analysis of the Finnish workforce by researchers at the University of Helsinki, published in the British Medical Journal, found that when a company downsized staff by 18% or more, it sparked a significant rise in the number of sick days taken by surviving employees. The main culprit? Stress from a heightened workload and the loss of workplace colleagues.
Hey, what does this word make you think of? Tchaikovsky.
Isn't it? So what's the word?
No, that is the word.
You lost me.
All right, who's Martha Graham?
She invented the graham cracker. Before her, there was only soda crackers.
Maybe they're not getting enough art. Kids who participate in the arts do better in school and in life. To learn more, visit AmericansForTheArts.org. Because all kids should get to appreciate Tchaikovsky's music and Martha Graham's dance. Art. Ask for more. A public service message brought to you...
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.